Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
For Valentine's, revitalize Day Spa in Birmingham. Get your Valentine's Day shopping done in minutes. Click here to go to revitalizedayspa.net and purchase a spa gift certificate online. It's easy, and she'll love it. Satisfaction guaranteed.
282-3333 or visit starregistry.com for this year's hottest Valentine's Day gift.
Hello, I'm Horace. I'm a magician.
How uninteresting.
Yes, and the coolest part about it is all the tax deductions I get, like this top hat and this bunny, even this giant coin.
How'd you do all that?
I got people.
Whatever your job, H&R Block can maximize your refund. Last year, we found over 2 million clients an average of $2,500 in deductions for employee expenses. When you got H&R Block, you got people. Learn more today at yougotpeople.com. Deductions are based on unreimbursed employee expenses.
Axe stinky poetry.
Smelly belly. You are so smelly, belly. There is a spray that smell must obey. Obey the spray! Obey the spray! Get fresh and no longer smelly, belly.
This has been sponsored by From Funky to Fresh. Kill odor-causing bacteria with Axe Deodorizing Body Spray.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
All right, Peter Werby is not here this week. He is, well, I can't tell you where he is, but I'll tell you one thing. Don't worry. He's not ill. He is not having any type of surgery. He's not even having plastic surgery, which we joked about last week, because that would be the last thing he would do. I'm Julian Jordan, his co-host in this week for him, and Peter will be back next week. And one thing I can tease you with, as we say in radio, is that he has a surprise for you. So that's part of the surprise, where he's been, and we'll tell you all about it next week. And he will be missed. But meanwhile, we have a show to do tonight. Welcome to Night Call. The number is here, 313-298-WRIF or 313-298-9743. You can also email calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And also, some of you may be streaming live at WRIF.com to wherever you're listening around the world, around the country, or right here in Detroit, where the big news this week in Detroit was, of course, Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick and the resignation of his chief of staff, Christine Beatty. And then the TV speech. Of course, there was the speech with Carlotta by his side. It was, I couldn't even watch it, to be honest with you. I just chose not to, and then read all about it later. So I'm pretty in the know about what he said. And, I don't care if you're diddling outside of your marriage. That's your business. It does bother me a little bit when you hold office. And we do hold our officials to a bit of a higher standard, wouldn't you say? We'd like to. Not that we get it. But what bothers me, and what we have been saying here all along with this, is that he committed perjury. He lied under oath on the stand this past summer about the nature of his relationship with his chief of staff. So now, what happens? I thought for sure in this speech, there was a possibility that he would resign. But no, like the cockroach that multiplies and never goes away, he's still with us. And his poor wife, sitting there having to listen to this, his poor children. And I say, out of all of this, I feel worse, probably worse for Carlotta and the people of Detroit, who have to put up with this circus of a mayoral government. Meanwhile, there's still that dead stripper that goes unsolved, right? So Kilpatrick now has hired his new chief of staff, Kendia Milton, a former college athlete. Like his predecessor, he comes with some baggage, so we're told. Well, apparently it's already been solved. You know how that happens in politics. He owed about $10,000 in delinquent city property taxes, and yet he was praised by City Hall officials for his work as the mayor's deputy chief of staff and liaison to the council. massaging an occasionally testy relationship between Kilpatrick and the council members. But by late afternoon, when this came out, which was Tuesday, the mayor's staff produced a copy of a time-stamped receipt showing that Milton had paid $9,418 in delinquent taxes at 3:47 p.m. that day. The taxes were owed on an East Side home owned by Milton and his wife. And this is from DetroitNews.com. It goes on to just give a laundry list of everything that he's done, quote-unquote, wrong. And, hey, it's politics, right? So there's that. If you feel like talking about that, I'm certainly here to listen. 313-298-WRIF. And I don't know. Is everyone over it? Are you over it? Do you think he should have resigned? Are we just, let's move on to what's going on, such as Super Tuesday. But before we get to that, don't forget the Florida primaries went on. Edwards is now out. The ghoul, Giuliani, is now out. And so that's another issue that we can touch. But we're, you know, like I said, we're on to Super Tuesday, 2 days away from that. We also, unfortunately, I refuse to watch it every year. I do read the text. The sorry State of the Union speech from Bush, that was this week as well. Full of its usual absurdities, and I have plenty to say about that speech coming up in the show. Bush's approval rating hovering at 29%. Ooh. And, oh, yes, Super Tuesday, the circus coming to town all over the U.S. Plenty of Obama seems to be the one who's most talked about, yet it's all eyes on Clinton, according to this recent AP story that came out just tonight. The top presidential candidates and their big-name supporters campaigned from coast to coast today, but one contender seemed atop everyone's mind, Hillary Rodham Clinton. And what this writer is talking about is that McCain and Romney are contrasting themselves and each other with Clinton. And so it seems clear that they look at her as their Democratic rival, not Barack Obama. And then Barack Obama played along to a degree, it says, saying Clinton is so polarizing that he is the Republicans' better bet. So he's hopping on that bandwagon. Everyone's after Hillary. And as we look at the numbers, Barack Obama seems to have gained on Hillary Clinton's lead in voter support nationwide, according to three new polls. Three new polls. It's Clinton at 47% and Barack Obama at 43%. Then when the last poll, January 12th ABC poll, it was Clinton 37%. And, or 42% rather, and Obama 37%. So that seems to be narrowing if you are into that whole poll kind of thing and even follow it. So yeah, it's been a frenzy before Super Tuesday. In fact, I don't know how these cats do it. I really have no idea. They, are all over the place, all over the country. And, oh, on the Republican side, by the way, just to be fair, it looks like McCain is quite a bit ahead of Mitt Romney right now. Those two are just like a show in themselves. They're almost really laughable, I have to say. The whole thing is a bit laughable at this point. But I am starting to kind of get into it. It just all started so early. There was too much too soon, and there's such burnout factor if you're really a political activist or a political junkie of any sort, no matter what side you're on. There is a burnout factor. So I love this one. This is from the Washington Post, which I love that newspaper, one that doesn't necessarily lean to the right like a lot of them do. Senator Barack Obama has two opponents, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, and the clock is what this says. 2 days to go before Super Tuesday, roughly half of the delegates in the Democratic presidential contest will be awarded this Tuesday. Half of them. It is a big day. Obama is racing around the country. Check this out. Tuesday, he went to Kansas. And then he went to Kansas City, Missouri. Then he hopped on a plane and went to Denver. Then to Phoenix. Then L.A. The next day, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Boise. I don't know how they keep up this pace, but I'll tell you, it's some kind of political juju that's going on there for sure. You know, there's been a lot of comparisons of Barack Obama and JFK in different ways. And There's a very interesting article by Frank Rich, op-ed in the New York Times from today, and I highly suggest you read the whole thing. I won't go through the whole thing, but it's basically how Kennedy was elected, and that he wasn't elected. It wasn't his ideas. It wasn't his experience, necessarily. It wasn't even the charisma that he would show off in the televised duels with Richard Nixon. It says here, looking back, he had to touch the secret fears and ambivalent longings of the American heart. Does it sound familiar? The secret fears and ambivalent longings of the American heart, and speak to the desires of a swiftly changing nation. His message grounded on his own intuition of some vague and spreading desire for national renewal. So in other words, Kennedy needed two things. He needed poetry, and he needed a country with some desire, however vague, for change. And Barack Obama certainly has that. It says here, for all the Barack Obama-JFK comparisons, whether legitimate or over the top, what has often been forgotten is that Mr. Obama's weaknesses resemble Kennedy's at least as much as his strengths. But to compensate for those shortcomings, he gets an extra benefit that JFK lacked in 1960. There's nothing vague about the public's desire for national renewal in 2008. There is no question about that. With a reviled incumbent in the White House and only 19% of the population finding the country on the right track, only 19% out there think we're on the right track. And that's according to the latest Wall Street Journal NBC News poll. America is screaming for a change. And I say amen to that one. So also going on with Super Tuesday, I mean, it's really getting silly, is Oprah. Oprah's out there in California. Maria Shriver is out there today speaking for Barack Obama. And this is what Oprah said, believe this or not. I thought if Barack Obama was a state, he'd be California. Diverse, open, smart, independent, innovative, inspirational, dreamer, leader. That's a pretty big vote. In fact, Barack's endorsements just keep piling in. The LA Times has now endorsed him. Like I said, Maria Shriver. And they just keep on piling on. It appears the UAW, they announced this evening that they're not going to endorse anyone in the Democratic Party in the primary. Ron Gettelsinger, UAW president, said, "The stakes in this election could not be any higher. Our jobs are on the line." And he reiterated the union's decision not to make an endorsement in the Democratic presidential primary, but called Clinton and Obama friends who would protect manufacturing jobs, support workers' rights to organize, and expand health care coverage. Do you believe that? 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. So more of the silliness with Hillary and Obama. You know, they've been at each other's necks, at throats, just... And suddenly, Maureen Dowd, who is one of my favorite op-ed writers in the New York Times, wrote one that came out today called There Will Be Blood. And she says, suddenly everyone was in the mood for love. Who could scream team? Would the scream team turn into the dream team? Yeah. Would the scream team turn into the dream team? After Thursday's Democratic debate, CNN's Carol Costello said there were heart palpitations and ripples of joy in the glittery Kodak Theater audience at the idea of a Hillary Obama or Obama Hillary ticket. Ah, did you hear that? After he was gallant with her, and she laughed gaily with him. How could Hollywood not fall in love with Hollywood's favorite plot? After lots of sparking and sparring, the couple falls into each other's arms in the last scene. The would-be matchmakers didn't seem to know that in Hollywood, couples who have chemistry on screen often don't like each other off screen. And ones who are involved off screen often don't have any chemistry on screen. And so it is with Barack and Hillary. Thursday night was not the beginning of a beautiful friendship, just a beautiful, dare we say, fairy tale. So there's that. Those two are a show in themselves. And I liked one other thing that I read was that Obama is speed dating the country. That's what he's doing with all this travel, speed dating the country. Remember that craze, speed dating? Oh, Lord, help us all. John McCain and Mitt Romney, meanwhile, going at it. And in another op-ed by Gail Collins, she says, the unbending John McCain takes on the deeply bendable Mitt Romney. Think G.I. Joe versus Gumby. I like that one. I think we're going to keep that one around for a while. Somehow, in the midst of all the frenzy, McCain has to transition from being an underdog to being a front runner. And this is from David Brooks from the New York Times. He's talking about the going back and forth between Mitt Romney. He's taken a bunch of shots at him. He said were gratuitous considering the circumstances, as he privately acknowledges. McCain also says we won't surrender in Iraq. And I'll tell you what, that's one that just really bothers me. What do you mean surrender? Can someone explain that to me? Surrender in Iraq? Well, just call in and we'll talk all about it. And meanwhile, we do have a call. Let's take one. Al, let's see how well I do with the phone system. Since I'm always in, Peter's the one who runs that show. We have Carl and Jackson. I hear you, Carl.
Hey, Ron, how you doing?
How you doing?
Not bad. Do you remember the movie Brewster's Millions?
Bush's Millions. You know, that's one I haven't seen. I've seen a lot of them. But tell me.
I'm going to put on my ballot none of the above.
Is that what you're going to put?
Oh, no. It's kind of hard, you know. I mean, I really don't trust either one of them.
You know? And you're talking between Clinton and Obama?
You know, I mean, it's less like, you know, but you don't know who to trust anymore. Sure the hell can't trust Bush.
Absolutely not. And he's proven that for the last 7 years.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, they're both, like we always say, is if it turns out it's either one of them, we'll hold our noses and vote for them, right?
Yeah. I really have no idea who the heck I'm. I usually know, get a good idea who I would like to vote. I ain't seen any of them. I'd really want it even behind the wheel.
Yeah. What would you think about a Clinton-Obama ticket, as I was talking about?
Well, let's see now. First, we'll be figuring out who's going to be putting girls behind the White House. Will it be Hillary or Bill?
Putting what behind the White House?
Bringing their girls in.
Oh, they're girls. Okay.
You know, the Secret Service is going to have a hell of a time trying to keep them apart.
Well, you know, I don't know what to say about that, but I think you got me there, Carl.
What can I say, you know? I just really, you know, Hillary's got a good educational background. Obama's got some good points as far as what we should do with the military, as far as cutting it down in overseas ventures. But other than that, I really don't know who I'd really trust behind the wheel, you know?
Well, yeah, and especially in light of the fact that Hillary voted to go over to Iraq. Obama was against it from the beginning. That does say something.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, the main thing that most people don't even think about with this war started with the Twin Towers getting attacked. Not many people in the United States actually knew somebody that was there. I do.
Okay. You mean as in the Twin Towers?
Personally.
Okay.
Personally.
Yeah.
When I grew up, my best friend across the street from me, his little sister, was going to college in New York. She got a job as a receptionist for the Twin Towers.
Mm.
When they were attacked, me and my buddy got in our cars and drove to New York. By the time we got to the New York border, we found out that she was found, but we thought we were going to dig out a body.
Mm.
Now, somebody that you put diapers on as a baby, imagine them been there.
Right, for sure. I will say that the war really started long before then, long before GW even got into office. He was planning
it
long before then.
Agreed.
But that when that happened, he said, okay, well, here we go, right?
Right.
All right. Hey, Carl, thanks a lot for calling in. We appreciate it. From Jackson.
Not a problem, hon.
Have a great one.
You too.
Okay. Bye. And let's see. Al? I did it. Yay. Let's go to Lars, who's in Sterling Heights.
Hi,
Lars. Hi, how are you?
So I talked to you about... Yeah, everyone's got those yellow bumper stickers that say support the troops.
Oh, the ribbons?
Yeah, but it's like to most people who watch Fox News, they think the worst thing you can do to a soldier is say something that might hurt their feelings.
Right.
You know, the real, you know, that's not even on the top 500. Extended deployments, you know, being involuntary recalls.
You know what I read today, Lars, is that the troops are spending as much time at home as they are over there. I mean, it's just back and forth, back and forth. You're an ex-Marine, it says here.
Yes.
And you were there?
Well, I was in over in 2005, but I spent most of the time on ships, so I just kept going to different countries.
Okay.
And it's like, we're only back for a couple of weeks, and then we're already starting a new training cycle for deploying overseas. And most of it's like they don't teach you. It's like they spend years training you to kill instinctively, and then they give you like a one-day course on, you know, handling, on dealing with civilians or on cultural sensitivity, and then, you know, they're shocked when, you know, you kill someone instinctively.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's go back to what you were talking about though with the bumper stickers, because I think I cut you at the pass there. Apologies.
Yeah, because it's if people who say like, well, then they say the surge is working. It's like, well, no, it isn't, because by, you know, recalling most of your whole bunch of troops, extending deployments, you basically max out the military and you still haven't got a sustainable peace. So that means if you actually want to go the next step to actual victory, you need probably to double the size of the army. And the only way you could do that is if you reinstated the draft, you know, commandeered factories, you know, issued, started rationing, and actually raised taxes to pay for the war instead of just getting loans from the Chinese or just printing money.
Yeah, sounds horrible.
Yeah,
and you read about the recent, they were saying months of relative calm. I mean, I want to know what they consider relative calm.
Yeah, they mean relative to what, 2005 or 2004 before?
Right, or even months. And last Friday, 58 people were blown apart by two different bombings in Baghdad at actually animal markets.
I remember hearing on BBC.
Yeah. Is that where you say you get a lot of your news?
Yeah, because I really hate the cable news. It's like, the you know, those Smucker's Uncrustables, little peanut butter and jelly sandwiches? That's what the cable news is. It's like no nutritional value, no substance. It's not filling. It's just designed to be there, easily consumed, and to be mass consumed, as opposed to, you know, actually going out and doing research and making your own sort of panini of news.
You know, that's one I'd never heard before. Did you come up with that by yourself?
Yes, I did.
Pretty good, Lars. Okay, well, thank you for calling in. We appreciate you.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, have a good one. And we'll get up, hang up from there. All right. 313-298-9743, 313-298-WRIF, if you would like to get on. We have some open lines here tonight. Julian Jordan in for Peter Werby. And yes, after months of relative calm, they say, two deadly blasts rocked Baghdad. This is what happened. It was two in within about a half hour of each other in Baghdad, one at one market, one at the other. And they were each females who strapped the bombs on and went in there. In recent months, there have been at least six female suicide bombers in different parts of Iraq, particularly in the Diyala province, which is north of the capital. So bad news. A lot of these shop owners are just deciding to close the shop, get out, that it's just getting worse and worse. So when you see the news, especially if you watch Fox News and they try to tell you that things are getting better, they're absolutely not getting better. And they absolutely are getting worse. In fact, we'll talk in the next half hour about the State of the Union speech by Bush and how much money he is now asking for in his new 2008 budget, which is record-setting. And we'll talk about a few other things that he is he really, when it came to Iraq, basically said he doesn't have a solution. So that's what we get, folks. And a total of 3,942 American service members now have been killed in Iraq as of this past Thursday. 3,942 American men and women are dead for what? 4,000 people. Unbelievable. We'll be back and we'll take your calls. Looks like we have some coming in. We have a couple open lines. So please, 313-298-WRIF. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. If you don't like talking on the air, you can email me.
WRIF.com. with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Welcome back. Julian Jordan in for Peter tonight. Peter will be back next week. 313-298-WRIF and 313-298-9743. Call TalkYes at yahoo.com as well. Had an email come in that I will get back to in just a bit. Wrong screen. But it has to do with basically they're sick of hearing about Kwame Kilpatrick, which I'm gathering because no one's calling in to talk about him. But we do have a call from Linkin Park. It's John, who apparently not too happy with something either Lars or I said. Lars, a former Marine. John, welcome to the program. It's Julian. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. You know, and I understand, as he, the former jarhead there says, you know, you're programmed to blindly walk into a hail of bullets at a moment's whim.
Okay, so you agree with him on that?
I do. But the only thing that gets me, and don't get me wrong, the soldiers that have already laid their life down for us,
yeah,
it's kind of odd because, you know, people don't realize, or I'm not sure if they don't really see it, of how many people have already laid their life down in, you know, previous wars, more in one day than we've had to pay this price in the whole time of this war that we've spent.
Okay.
I mean, do you, not
I guess. I guess I don't. For me, I have a little different take on it. Is that I feel the men and women are laying their lives down or dying, quite frankly, because of an illegal war where Bush went in there so he could control oil,
well,
or the price of oil.
You're right, and you know you're still wrong.
Okay. Okay. How am I wrong? Please tell me, John. I'm open, man.
Okay. Look at it like this. By saying that this was a bad war,
yeah,
and that we walked in, there was nothing, we even should have been there, is like saying that Saddam Hussein should still have the right to just start killing people with the drop of a thumb, or let's just say.
Okay, I can understand, you know, I don't agree with you, but I respect your opinion. I'll say that, okay, John?
That's fine. Hey,
yeah.
You know, that's what we're talking about.
That's what
right?
We're here for. I don't agree at all. And I think, were you over there?
I went over. I worked civil service after I got out of the Corps and everything for, let's just say, San Antonio C-5 B-52 section.
Okay.
And I went over during the first Gulf. I was Desert Shield.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's just say, I still to this day, why is it that, you know, America has such bountiful things, but yet any other third world country, we just have to let them go and let the people of dictators do with their people as they feel?
I wonder why we, as the United States, are the rulers of the world, are the bullies of the world. I don't know how we self-appoint ourselves in that position, and not we, but the government, and namely George Bush. I don't understand it, I don't agree with it, and I never will.
I don't agree with what George Bush did, okay? But I don't believe it's right for one man to pave his roads with his own people and try and tell me I'm wrong about that.
Well, I think George Bush is doing a similar thing. I hate to say it. John, we appreciate you calling into the show.
Hey, not a problem, man. Anytime.
Okay, you have a great night.
You
vote?
You too.
Are you voting on Super Tuesday?
Oh, you bet you.
Who are you voting for?
Well,
will you tell me?
How about Romney?
Oh, really?
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Oh, why not? Okay, if that's your answer.
Well, it's not like that, okay?
Okay.
To be quite honest with you, I'm afraid if Obama makes it, he's going to have a crosshair on his forehead.
A crosshair on his forehead?
Well, everybody's talking Camelot and Kennedy. I mean, well, look what happened.
Okay. Well, I think they're I think they're all frightening.
I do, too. I really do. I feel there's no real clear answer here.
That's true. Well, we'll just have to see how it all pans out. It'll be quite interesting, won't it, John?
Yeah, not a problem. I listen to you guys all the time.
Right on, man. Peter will be back next week.
Hey, you too?
Okay. Yeah, I'll be back,
I like having you here. It's a pretty good change.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Hey, you guys have a good one.
Thank you. You too. Thank you, John. And I appreciate Peter trusting me with his show. Been producing for him for 10 years now in one form or another. So we've been together a long time. Let's go to Flint and talk to Garrett, who also wants to talk about the war. Garrett, welcome to the program.
Hello, Jalene. How are you?
Hello. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm saddened by the calls that I'm hearing on this show tonight.
Which ones?
Well, specifically, there was a guy that called in that said this war that we're in right now, if you even want to call it that,
right,
like started when we were attacked on 9/11.
Right. Well, you heard my response to that, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I was in total agreement, but I think he kind of glossed over that, and I don't know. I just didn't get his point. I mean, this war started a long time ago. This war has started. The United States has been this country that goes into other people's countries, bombs their people, kills their people, takes their resources since, what, like 1813 or something?
Oh.
Like since after the Revolutionary War, this is what we've been doing. And this ignorance of what our country's been doing is a symptom of this disease. Of, and, you know, this last guy that was just now talking about this abundance that we have this abundance because we're stealing it from other people.
Right.
You know? Like, it doesn't come from nowhere. We don't have, we have some oil in our country. We don't have a ton of oil in our country. We get it from other countries, you know, and that's how we operate. That's how this country operates. It's, you know.
And we export.
Yeah.
As well.
Well, export.
Oil.
Oil, yeah. And it's, you know, like, I don't know. I just wish people would just, you know, turn off the television, these slogans, like, support our troops, you know, like, whatever,
yeah.
Whatever. But, and just realize that you're living the life that you're living because a lot of the rest of the world is suffering. And that's all I can say, I guess.
Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Garrett. Thanks for calling in.
No problem.
All right. Have a great night. All right, bye-bye. And, okay, well, once we hang Garrett up here, we have an open line. We have, other than that, quite a few phone calls to get to. Let's go to Margaret in East Lansing, who has been waiting for about 10 minutes, so we don't like to keep you waiting too long. Here we go. Margaret, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
How are you?
I'm fine. I just wanted to let you know that I love your show, and I think that you and Peter are awesome.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
I wanted to ask you a question, getting back to the polls and Hillary, and I wondered what you thought you're saying that Hillary is kind of in the lead as far as that goes. I know it goes back and forth from day to day, but
yeah.
What you thought the critical issues that, as far as her efforts to keep the interest of the people during this whole political puberty race.
Well, I think that, you know, the economy is hot right now, and she's really playing that card. But I think the key issue that hurts her is the fact that she voted for the war and then changed her mind. I think that's one place where Obama wins that vote. Who do you like?
It's a toss-up. Right now I haven't made a formal decision. It's kind of hard. I mean, we don't have the best choices. Like we ever do, but I've lost a lot of faith in the voting. As a result of the last two elections and how those went down. I think that situation is just horrendous. Not that I'll quit voting, but it's hard to just at this point, and it's hard to believe in your vote.
Right. Well, apparently Hillary had declared that she would have this race wrapped up by February 5th, which is, Tuesday, Super Tuesday. But now her strategists are saying, as Obama appears to be closing the gap, she needs the days until then to keep pushing her message. And so she's out there making it happen. Doesn't it sound exhausting?
It does. And you were talking about Obama's been absolutely everywhere across the country,
yeah.
and touring real hard. It's just kind of a crazy pace to keep up for these last couple of days before, the Tuesday comes along.
It's a circus.
Yep. Da-da-da-da-da.
Hey, so you're not one of these women who is just pro-Hillary because she's a woman, huh?
No. No, okay. Absolutely not. I would like a good leader, for the nation.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, that isn't going to lie to us. I know that, in politics, has a lot of corruption in it, but, you know, I mean, it can't be all lies. I'm just tired of it, and I think that the nation is fed up with it at this point.
Finally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's taken too long, I think.
Right, absolutely. I know. I'm fed up completely. All right, Margaret, thanks for calling in from East Lansing.
All right.
Listening live, I'm sure, at WRIF.com. Have a great night.
All right, you too. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, and let's go to Dearborn, where we have Samantha standing by. Samantha, welcome to the Peter Werby Show. It's Julene. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing really well tonight. Thank you.
Good.
Yeah, I was just calling in because tonight I was watching the Super Bowl with some friends, and we were discussing politics, and I've been
nice.
Hearing a lot.
What
yeah,
a combo.
You know, oh, I'm sorry. Go on.
No, I said nice. What a combo. I'm glad that you could watch the Super Bowl and throw in a little politics there.
Well, we kind of had to because I'm sure everybody caught it, but right in the beginning there was a lot of, like, you know, references to our, like, nation's history and the Declaration of, like, Independence and a bunch of other, you know, politically propelled propaganda was there. So we were talking about the candidates and whatnot, and a subject had come up that has been increasingly bothering me with people.
Okay.
And that's when we pick apart the Democratic Party and its frontrunners for being either black or being a woman.
Okay, because why does it have to be about that? That's annoying. Is that what you're saying?
Why does it have to be about that? Because
yeah.
of the fact that either, like, they kept saying, like, nobody's going to vote for Barack because he's black, or no one's going to vote for a woman, but the country isn't ready enough for this.
Right.
But I really think it's an excuse. It's either, like, our way of covering up for the fact that we still might have, like, some kind of string of prejudice in our society,
right.
or else we're just too afraid to really, like, take that leap into something that we really think has, like, evolved, you know, from our current point in culture, you know?
I think it could be a little bit of both, Samantha, to be honest with you, because I know there, sadly enough, I really believe our country has not evolved as far as you and I wish it,
right.
you know. I there are a lot of people out there who are like, oh, that time of the month, what if she's all crazy and she's going to press that button? You know, I mean, I heard this just a few weeks ago from someone who said it right to my face.
Yeah.
And I thought, I looked at this guy, I go, you're joking, right?
Right.
And he was not joking. And he said, I'm just telling you, this is what the men and around me are saying. And I thought, okay, so there we are with that. We have periods, so we can't run a country.
Exactly, when we have real issues.
Yeah.
And I really think that the way that, you know, a lot of people, either we're having these feelings either because, like, we're told to, or maybe they're still there from past history. But, you know, I think that it's kind of crazy that, like, the media would push the issue of these things that really don't matter to us right now. And here in America, and then sit there and push, like, the economy, and then run a poll and say that the Republicans are the only ones trusted by the American public to be able to deal with the economy. So what I feel is going on is that they're picking apart a way for us so that we feel like we have a way to change,
mm-hmm.
but they know that we're almost afraid to change. So by the time we get a front runner up there, you know, the Republicans are going to come up with on a platform saying that they're going to save the economy, thus, like, taking away from, you know, the real changes that I think that one of those candidates might bring to this, you know, to our, you know, position on the world.
Right. I hear you there. Are you leaning one way or the other at all?
I am, yes.
Okay. Do you want to say or not?
Of course. I'm a Barack Obama supporter.
Okay. And what is it that separates him from Hillary to you?
Well, I think that the fact that he's incredibly honest is extremely refreshing. I mean, I'm tired of, like, watching people smile and wave and talk about things that they think I want to hear. But what they're really not doing is taking into effect that us as Americans, like, are slowly watching a lot of our rights being taken away.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And
Trampled on, Samantha.
Exactly. Like, you know, people don't notice the news reports that are happening right now. Like, I just watched on CNN the other day, down in, like, a little blurb while we were messing around with the issues of it being either a black or a woman thing, that somebody, and I can't be accredited to this, but in a prison had their, you know, Quran taken away from them because of some reason. I'm not quite sure, but it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled against the fact that that was his constitutional right to have it. And I'm like, how can we let these things happen in our country? We should be protecting everybody here.
Absolutely.
Like, we're all good people, you know? Like, why do we have to fight over these issues when, I don't know.
Yeah, it's very frustrating. I feel your pain, Samantha.
I don't know.
I feel your pain.
I wish for the best, and I hope that, you know, the election is a fair and honest thing, that we actually do have the voice and the say to make a difference in our own country.
Oh, let's hope so. Hey, before you go real quick, since you said you watched the Super Bowl, don't say who won, because there are a lot of people who probably have T-voted it, and I know one is our producer, Al Slayer, here. Did you see the Obama advertisement? I know he ran ads during the Super Bowl, which...
Actually, we got a lot of local television, too, which was kind of weird.
Okay, yeah, well, I didn't see it either because I didn't watch it. I was prepping for the show and watching the Puppy Bowl. But if anyone did see the Obama ad, I'd be curious about how it was. And can you imagine how much money he spent? What was it, $2.5 million per 60-second ad this year? Insanity! Okay, Samantha, thanks for calling Night Call tonight. Okay, have a great one. We appreciate you calling in. 313-298-9743, 313-298-WRIF. And we go to Dave in Detroit, who has been waiting patiently. He's also an ex-Marine, wants to talk about the war. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Julian, how are you?
I'm great. And you?
I'm sick to my stomach, really. I mean, I've been, I don't know if you saw the Republican debate recently or just in general, people need to wake up. I don't understand what's so hard for people to understand what's really going on. I mean, you got troops, actual army soldiers making videos on YouTube, basically pleading to be sent home because they're admitting that they're over there. They're not fighting terrorists. They're fighting soldiers. They're fighting people who want their country back because they're tired of 50 years of intervention by the U.S. installing, you know, this leader, that leader, putting that person out of power. I don't understand what's really going on. And then I hear callers calling, talking about how there's no good choices. There's one good choice. His name is Ron Paul. But you wouldn't know about him because nobody wants you to know about him because he is so far against what the status quo is right now. He refuses to bow down to the big corporations. He refuses to lie in bed with the same people that are raping our infrastructure and making us go broke. And it makes me sick because, you know, I didn't give up 4 years of my life to see this happen to the place that I damn near died for, pretty much.
So you're a Ron Paul guy. I have a question for you, and this is one I've been dying to ask it on the air before. But as things start to wind down, we have Super Tuesday in 2 days. My question to the Ron Paul folks, because, well, I hate to say it, but I just don't think he's going to be your guy. I don't want him, but for you, I hate to say it to you, that he's probably not going to get in there, right? Who will you turn to?
I hope. Real badly that Obama winds up being the guy from the Democratic Party, because honestly, if anybody thinks Hillary Clinton's going to be anything different than anything we've had, they're insane. When Hillary Clinton first ran for office in New York, it was a well-orchestrated plan down the road that they were going to try to put her in the presidency. I mean, if you look at her record, she doesn't care about being a senator in New York. She just wants to vote and get the right people on her side. So, you know, now she's got all these millions of dollars she can spend on her campaign.
So Barack is your obvious choice. Hillary is definitely not the choice for me. I'm with you there.
No.
What would you do? What about this one? What if it were Hillary and Barack were her vice president?
I wouldn't really like that very much, but I would hope.
Would you do it? Would you hold your nose?
Well, if it was a choice between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Mitt Romney and, say, John McCain, I'd have to vote for Hillary, even though if she were president, I don't think any good would really come out of it. It would just be an orchestra. It would just be Bill Clinton, you know, a president. Again, anybody who thinks differently, I think, is mistaken, because they're just another family who came into power, and they don't want to lose the power that they got, just like the Bushes, just like the Kennedys, just like pretty much any family who's ever really done well and wanted to hold on to the success, you know, in this country.
Dave, let me ask you this.
Sure.
Don't you think that Hillary would be a little bit better than George Bush?
Oh, well, of course.
Okay.
I mean,
okay.
I have to give you that one.
All right.
But real quick, I don't want to take up all your time, but, I'm not opposed to a woman president. I just don't want Hillary.
Okay. All right, so you're not one of these guys who says, oh, what about that month when she's bleeding? Oh.
No, no, that's, I that makes me so sad that people really think that way. I mean, the thing that made me not want her as president is when she cried on TV, and it was a plan. She did it right when she knew the cameras were going to be there.
What the hell was she crying about? I don't remember that.
I don't even remember, because the campaign's been so difficult for her, and how difficult has it really been, staying in five-star hotels and having lobster salad for lunch? How difficult really is that?
You make a good point, Dave. Okay. Well, thank you for calling in. You have a great night. Thanks for calling Night Call.
I love the show. Keep up the good work, Julie.
Thank you so much, Dave. We love having you listening. 101 WRIF, this is the Night Call program. Peter Werby is back next week. Let's go to Bill, who is standing by on the phone lines in Roseville. Wants to talk about the war. Welcome, Bill.
Hello.
Thank you.
Basically, I've got two brother-in-laws over there right now. One's in southern Baghdad, one's stationed in Tikrit.
Wow.
And the one in Tikrit's on his second tour of duty. And
how old are they?
The one's 21 and the other one's 35.
Oh, my.
And pretty much, basically, I mean, when people sit there and talk about the war, yeah, you know, I don't agree with the way he went in. I mean, I agree we should have went in, but we shouldn't have gone in under the skies that he put up of the weapons of mass destruction and all that good stuff.
Why do you think we should have gone in there?
You're looking at 12 years, we were holding no-fly zones and this and that, and how long were we supposed to just keep doing that while he kept thumbing his nose at the UN and getting all these different resolutions?
You know that he being Saddam Hussein, he actually suggested that they sit down and discuss. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. But
okay.
I mean,
so Saddam Hussein at one point was more sane than George Bush.
Right. I mean, the problem is, I mean, you look at his past track record and you got to say, yeah, every time we discuss and go for a new resolution, you're talking, what, it was 15 resolutions over 12 years that he had thumbed his nose at. And it was like, you know, eventually we're going to have to go in anyway. I don't agree with the premise that we went under. I mean, believe me, that's, you know, if you're going to go in, it better be on a truth-based and fact-based mission.
Which it absolutely was not.
Right.
And I have to say, just stop you there, and I don't agree we should have gone at all, but go ahead.
Right. But, and then people, the thing I get about is people pinning a lot of the deaths on Bush. You know, I'll give them that first 1,500, but then once you start seeing all the people that were coming out, you know, you're showing a divided country, and it just emboldened the terrorists. After that, all those people also have the blood on their hands of the troops. I mean, because, they're emboldening the people that were trying to defeat, and they're just giving them more ammunition to keep going in. And, you know, oh, look, there's other people that think the same way as us, that, you know, and it just gave them more ammunition and more ability to recruit. So along the same lines, as much as George Bush has the blood on his hands, so do the rest of us who spoke up so loudly and vehemently against the war, because it helped embolden those anti-Americans.
Well,
you know?
I'll tell you what, I think that I'm not going to take one bit of credit for what's going on over that, because credit is a positive thing, and what's going on over there is absolutely criminal, and that people are dying every day, and that 4,000 U.S. American soldiers are dead, and then let's name the hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians who are dead. For what? I just could never go there, but Bill, I sure appreciate you calling the show tonight.
All right.
Okay?
Yep.
Have a good one.
You too.
Okay. Go out and vote on Super Tuesday.
All right.
Bye. All right. Thank you, Bill, in Roseville. I couldn't agree less. Never should have gone in there. No business in there. We need to get the hell out of there. Let's go to Woodhaven. William, who's been very patiently waiting. You were formerly in the Army, I see, William.
Yes, Julian.
Welcome.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I don't know. I was getting off of work, and I heard you talking about Iraq, and I'm real passionate about it, and it's really upsetting, especially after hearing McCain talk so much. Anybody that wants to talk for all of the troops is just wrong in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And what do you think about how McCain is now saying, we won't surrender in Iraq?
You know, me and a lot of my friends joined right after September 11th. We put our faith in the government, and that's all we could do, and hope that wherever we were going, what we were doing was for the right reason. When you're over there, it's just ridiculous. We're doing raids on houses for weapons. We're checking on the police force, who half the time is sleeping on their posts.
The raids are very random, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, we get intel, good or bad. We break into these people's houses, scare the living daylights out of them. But another point is, like, the police force and the forces over there, we're working our tails off, going to their post to check on them because they're the ones also getting killed, and half the time they're sleeping.
And you're talking about the Iraqis?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, when we went in there, we fired all the entire police force, the entire everyone with anything to do with security. We fired them all. And then we wanted them to come back. And then we had to start paying them. But there are many Iraqi men who don't want anything to do with it because they don't want to die.
Exactly. They should see all the
They're a target themselves, right?
Yes, they are. They're a very big target, but they still seem to have the same passion as some of the people that are over there. And at the same time, you know,
I don't know how they could have any passion. I don't know how anyone could have any passion for anything but trying to survive.
Exactly.
Yeah?
That's all it is over there right now, just survival. I mean, and there's so much money there. I don't get how the political aspect comes in when people are less concerned about the economy or more concerned about the economy in Iraq. I mean, don't the two go hand in hand?
They absolutely do. And you know what? I am going to, after a break, discuss that. So stand by. We're going to talk about Bush's sorry State of the Union address. We're going to talk about this new budget that he's requesting that is absolutely insane. So we'll talk about what's being spent on the defense and what's being taken away from you and I, William. Thanks for calling. We'll be back on Night Call in just a few minutes. We'll take your calls. Everyone who's on hold, be patient. I will get right to you.
Crying with you, pray what do you know? Go. Chicago. I'm going to Chicago.
On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, Peter Werby, not here this week. A special surprise for you when he gets back next week. And we'll just leave you with that. Very excited to share special surprises, news, and information. And that's all I'm going to say. He's well, he's not sick. Don't worry. And he is not going away. Okay? Okay, let's do this. Let's go back to the phones, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We're talking about, guess what? The war! Also, we're talking about the candidates, the Super Tuesday that's coming up in 2 days, and a variety of other. And no one wants to talk about Kwame. In fact, I did receive an email, and that was from, let's see, it's from Joe in Westland. Please don't talk about the mayor this evening. I'm so sick of it, it and him. The people of Detroit will reelect this man just as the people of D.C. reelected their mayor, even though he was caught on videotape smoking crack with a hooker in a hotel room. The people of Detroit get what they deserve by electing this hip-hop 30-something high school football player. That's Joe emailing in. That's his personal analysis. Also got an email from Todd, who says, I have a friend who grew up Republican. I had a conversation with him recently. He was telling me how he thinks the unions are ruining the big three. He felt it was outrageous that a forklift driver was making $80,000 a year. I noticed a similarity between him and most Republicans. They seem to hate the middle class and despise the poor. Why do Republicans hate the people they have made money off of? That's a very good question. Coming in from Todd. Thanks for emailing calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Back to the phones. Larry is calling. I'm not sure where you're calling from, Larry. Welcome to the program. Where are you?
Oh, hi. I'm from Richmond Township.
Okay, welcome. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, thank you, Julian. I appreciate being on the air here.
Sure.
Basically, well, first thing I would like to say is my hats go off to the men that are in Iraq right now.
And women.
God bless their souls. Yes, men and women. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
But, you know, God bless their souls, because, I mean, they're fighting for the beliefs of, you know, what our country's about and everything. I mean, and it's sad that, I mean, like with Bush, I really don't understand, and I'm surprised people don't understand, that they have absolutely no proof of weapons of mass destruction. They said, well, we're going to come out when the time is right, and we'll show you the proof. And then they turn around and they say, well, we didn't have proof of it. But he was a bad man. He killed all millions of people. And, yeah, he did. You know, but you don't go in and just start annihilating a whole country because you got one bad man in there.
Right, exactly. You could not be more correct, Larry. And I that's one other thing. What about all of these lost phrases? If anyone can think of any, I've kind of been compiling my own list. Like, for example, weapons of mass destruction, or you know, the color-coded alarm system, and, you know, Osama bin Laden. Why don't we hear his name anymore? And, in fact, Larry, do you know, things are so bad in Afghanistan now that, you know, we wiped out supposedly the Taliban, and they have multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, where they're thinking about taking some troops out of Iraq and sending them back to Afghanistan. It's a complete mess.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, I just don't understand. I don't know how he gets away with it. I mean, do they convict people for war crimes? I mean,
They should.
You know, it blows my mind. And people, you know, I mean, I sympathize. Yeah, the man was an evil man. There's no doubt about it.
He was no sweetheart.
We should have went a different way of going about, you know. I mean, first thing we had was the terrorist attacks, you know, the 911 and everything. And yet we're not even worried about that. We're going to, you know, Iraq, you know. What the hell is going on here?
Well, I'll tell you what is going on. What's going to, the result of it is we're making it worse. We've stirred the hornet's nest, and then some. So anyone who thinks we're safer today because of all of the security measures and the wiretapping, for crying out loud, that is completely illegal, and everything that Bush has done in the name of our civil liberties to supposedly protect this nation, we are way worse off. In fact, you should be way more scared than you ever were. I hate to say it, and I hate to create, you know, fear in anyone, but it's also
right.
Reality. So, okay.
Well, I think they honestly like that, though. They want to have fear in everybody.
Yeah, so they can sneak all of these little things in and then continue to make all of this money as long as they can.
Right. Well, do you think that they're also maybe lighting up on our defenses as far as, you know, trying to show the people that, hey, you know, we're letting these people in to make these attacks? I mean, because, like, if you remember the time when there was that one plane, the single carrier plane, that was getting close to the White House, and they were ready to blow him right out of the air.
Yeah.
If he didn't stop and turn and make his defense.
I remember that one. That guy was almost a goner for making a mistake flying in the
right.
wrong direction.
And to tell me that, you know, just that single plane that's in our own country can do that, and, you know, it's just a fear tactic. They just want people to be scared, you know, of the terrorists. It's like the old days with communism.
Yeah, the McCarthy era, all of that. You got that right, Larry. Well, thank you so much for calling the Night Call program tonight.
Well, thank you, Julian.
All right.
Appreciate it.
You bet. Hang in there. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Back to the phone lines for Gerardo, who is in Detroit. Wants to talk about the candidates. Gerardo, welcome to the program.
Hello, Julian. Hey, well, you know what? I just have to say, especially for right now, see, a woman can take charge and can take the reins of a nationally syndicated television show, do it with perfect elegance. I think you could run the country, too. So.
Are you talking about me?
Yeah, why not?
Oh.
Well, you know what? Well, I mean, okay.
I'm flattered.
But here's a point.
And guess what? If I had my period, I wouldn't do anything crazy.
Yeah, right. Hey, but what's Bush's excuse? That means he's been on a period for the past, what, 7 years?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'm going to be nice. I'm trying to be nice.
All right. Let's try. Okay, we're going to put on our nice caps.
Yeah, well, you know what? See, I wanted to express, I want to give good accolades to you, especially for conducting the program, mainly because I have heard different programs, radio programs, even on public radio, and from using not just scare tactics, but sexist comments and scare tactics,
yeah,
to even racial scare tactics.
Or racist. Racist.
Yes. And, you know, it's just like, you know, people have fought and died for us to have the right to vote. But it's being misused because people, well, it's like, okay, if you on your program there were to say something, you know, racist, something,
mm-hmm,
or even if it was, you know, like a fact that was proven, you know, by history's accounts, you know, would you be picketed, boycotted, and say, and one reason would be brought up, not to offend you, but to say that, one, either, yeah, sure, okay, you know, she's having her womanly problems, or...
They're not problems. They're not problems. It's wait, stop, yeah. Gerardo. They're not problems. They're the reason you're even on this earth. Go ahead.
Yeah. But, you know what, see, the only reason why... Especially guys say anything bad about Hillary, most of them.
Yeah.
It's because they're afraid of a strong woman. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's like we're the only country that, I mean, look, we even turn our back on the metric system. And all these other countries, many of them, they do have women and their, I guess what, presidencies, prime ministers, what have you.
Yes.
You know.
Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Margaret Thatcher. You know, I mean, or look at Bill Clinton had Madeleine Albright. She actually went into the Middle East, and when they said, our culture, you must do this, she says, I'm the Secretary of State of the sent by the President of the United States. I'm here on business. And most of those men were just like, okay, that's it. You know, a strong woman. And see,
yeah.
I have no problem against a strong woman. I just don't, it offends me, and it offends the intelligence, especially a woman in this country. Well, plain and simple, women, please hear me, of the United States of America.
We're listening.
You can actually right now prove, and you know, you can actually put yourselves in the top and not have to appease a man. I mean, plain and simple, not to say like, you know, just
I'm already there.
Yeah, not just to say like vote for Hillary because she's a woman and so are you. That's not correct. But if Hillary becomes the president of the United States, right there, women in this country, the United States of America, can actually stand up and say, you know what, our place is no longer in the kitchen anymore, and no man can tell us that anyways.
And you know what the great news, Gerardo, is?
Uh huh.
That, well, I for one am already that way.
Yeah.
But I do believe the country. Just a little bit of spark there. I think there are a lot of women who are with me out there listening right now,
yeah,
who feel the same way. But I will agree with you that, okay, we are still viewed by many as second-class citizens,
yeah,
that we're receptacles for babies,
yeah,
that we have...
Or also, too, that there's... I mean, come on, there was even some Republicans that even Strom Thurmond even said things about... He even said things about, like, one, that biologically inept, and... I mean, I'm not going to say many of the different...
Yeah, he's a real sweetheart.
I mean, there were so many different things.
But
it's like, I mean...
Is that guy still around? Didn't he die?
No, he died. Are you kidding? Hey, the mummy never died.
He died. Didn't he?
I don't know either.
That's how forgettable that guy is to me.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
Okay, can I just... here's especially one other thing, because, like, see, many other people, it's like, I heard this one DJ on the radio. I don't remember his name. He was black, and I loved the way he said it. He referred to O.J. Simpson and Michael Jackson. He said throughout their careers, they may not have really expressed or hinted on their ethnicity. Okay, you know, being black, having roots to Africa or what have you. He said, but when they come into trouble, legal trouble, I mean, as he put it, I'm quoting him, when their back is against the wall, they're black against the wall.
Oh, my.
Meaning, in order to get the support of the black community to help rally behind them, you know, it's like that's when, you know, to do, you know, it's like to get the help, to really say, oh, now I'm black, you know, I need your help. You know, I'm being oppressed. You know, and I wish I knew who this gentleman's name was. I don't even remember the station. I remember it was an AM station. But especially with that, one thing that is so deep with me, I wanted to just share with everybody else out there, Galatians 6, 7, and 8. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap.
Now, there you go, right there. Thank you, Gerardo. We appreciate you calling in. And what you sow, you reap. What you reap, you sow. Gerardo, have a great one. We appreciate you calling the Night Call program here at 313-298-9000. 973-313-298-WRIF. Call talk yes at yahoo.com. And Roderick wrote in talking about the candidates. Maybe they are all mutated lizard squid octopuses underneath the candidate's skin. And that dude shouldn't vote for Romney, he says. And I agree. Get the hell out of Iraq. Duh. Thank you, Roderick. You know, another funny piece that I saw this week, you know, that vile, vile right-wing Ann Coulter. She is just awful. Well, she says, well, here's how it goes. We know the far right is upset with John McCain as a nominee, but this is really going too far. Ann Coulter, although I love this, she asserted on Fox News that if McCain gets the nomination, she would not only vote for Hillary, she would campaign for her. If it's McCain, campaign for her. She told Sean Hannity last Thursday that Clinton is more conservative than John McCain and added in that scenario, she will be our girl. How about those bones? And we were just talking to a listener, a couple of listeners who say that she's just way too much the same. And so Ann Coulter, I think, is confirming that with you. Let's go back to the phone lines. Flint, Michigan, it's Steve, and he wants to talk about the candidates. Steve, welcome.
Hello, how are you doing?
Hi, there you are. I thought maybe you'd gone away.
No, I'm here.
I left you on hold for a long time. Thank you for being patient. What's on your mind?
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, you're talking about these candidates and stuff, and they all have their faults, and they all have their good points and this and that, but it seems like every time you talk to one of them, they wave around a subject or they wave around this and that.
Yeah.
When they get in there, politics basically is run by Congress and everything else. It's not going to be that much of a change no matter who's in there.
But don't you agree? Or are you, wait, I guess I don't even know. Are you a Democrat, Republican, Independent, may I ask?
Well, I guess I'm a Republican.
Okay. So, you would not agree with me then when I say anyone on the left would be better than Bush?
No, I don't think that Hillary or Barack has any experience. They've only one term senator, and she's never done anything at all. They've never put any bills in and hadn't done anything. And then Barack, what has he done? I mean, he hasn't done anything, hasn't signed any bills, and done any leading in the Senate or anything like that.
Well, you know what Barack says? He says that this is perfect, that he is the clean slate, Steve.
Well, clean slate, but once again, he hasn't been faced with the problems of the USS Cole being attacked and this embassy and that and this person and that. He hasn't been faced with those decisions, so of course he's going to be right on everything. He's going to be fresh. He's going to be clean. But he hasn't been in a situation where he has to make those decisions. All he's had to do is vote or not vote on issues that come across his desk. And in most cases, he hasn't voted.
Okay, another question. Are you one of these Ron Paul types?
No.
It's okay if you are.
No. If I was going to vote for anyone, I probably would vote for Romney.
For Romney.
That would be Romney. But that would be based on the fact that he's basically already run many companies, and he knows how to do things as far as financial end of it. If you listen to Hillary, and first thing she says is, oh, well, We aren't going to run this as a business. Well, it is a business.
Well, she is going to run it as a business, and Mitt Romney will as well. And it will be all another, with Romney especially, a payoff to all of his friends the corporations.
Okay. First of all, the corporations are what this country is based on. We do exports. We do innovative things.
But what about the workers? What about the workers? And what about a fair and living wage for all Americans?
Well, once again, if you go out and you work, you put your day in, if you do a good job, you get promoted. If you do an average job, you get paid average.
Well,
if you do a below average job, you get let go. That has nothing to do with who's in the presidency. Jimmy Carter was probably the nicest person around. And we were at double-digit inflation. And we had hostages taken in Tehran and all that.
I don't think that was, you know, because he was in office.
Well, exactly why he was in office. When you're in there, you set policy. It's not set for then. It's 5, 6, 8 years down the road, just like Clinton with this NAFTA. He didn't initiate it. The Republicans did, but he was the guy that signed it.
Okay.
That's going to go down in history as his.
Well, Steve, we appreciate you calling in and giving us your opinion. And Mitt Romney, huh?
Well, if I had to vote on any of those, I think he's probably got as much experience being a governor, running the state, financially, fiscally, I think he's
right
there.
I'll give you this one. Well, actually, I think he's got the most experience being a BSer. But they're
all
full of it.
There's not one of them that's clean.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, hey, we agree on something, Steve. All right,
sure.
Thanks for calling the Night Call program.
Okay, goodbye.
Have a great week, and Super Tuesday. I know what you'll be doing. Let's see, also waiting quite a while, Linkin Park. John in Linkin Park. And John, welcome to the Night Call program. It's Julene. Welcome, and what's on your mind?
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
Doing fine. Having a great time filling in for Peter. Sure miss him, though.
I'm doing excellent, too.
Good.
Chilling back. I just been listening for a little while, and there's a couple of points I was on to talk about. As it stands for, you know, the normal people, or I mean the average people, I have a son that's 20 years old that joined the Army recently, just for basically economic reasons. Or just
Recently.
And you know, basically it's just for economic reasons. There's not a whole lot of jobs going on out here in Michigan right now, and, you know, it seemed like a good alternative to him, and he's a smart kid, and they offered him a $25,000 signing bonus, so he jumped on bandwagon real quick. Incidentally, Mr. Bush decided in his brightest wisdom and glory to suspend the monies that they were talking about, the bonuses.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So we're having a problem here. My son's not real happy right now. He signed up for 5 years, and all of a sudden he says, "Dad, the son of a bitch suspended our bonuses, and I don't know what I'm going to do. I've done racked up credit cards and got an apartment out here in Oklahoma. What do I do?"
Is he going to Iraq?
Well, there's a good possibility of that. Either Iraq or Afghanistan, one of the two, and he's not happy about either, especially now that he's not getting a signing bonus.
Well, I should say, I would be pissed. Now, how are you? This is your son?
This is my son.
And I just don't know how you are holding it all together, just even the thought of him. How old is he?
He's 20 years old.
He's just a baby.
Yes, he is just a baby. And he's going out there to, you know, clean up messes that we started up over a couple of years ago now.
You got
several
that right.
Years.
Yeah, seven.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically.
We are not happy about it. And, you know, we share pretty much the same the same ideas about, you know, why we're in certain conflicts overseas and stuff
okay.
like that. But,
okay. Well,
like
we wish your son the best, John.
Yep. Yeah, he's doing all right. I wanted to go into
Did you want to talk about the female president thing?
Yeah, we can do that. Sure.
It's up to you.
We can do that.
Go right ahead.
I have an opinion about that.
Okay.
The female president thing, it doesn't really bother me.
Well, good.
What I would like to see, and I always try to do, and, you know, I'm 42 years old, so I've voted a few times.
Yeah.
I would like to have a president in office that has some common sense and you know, is not all about the hype and would like to actually do something good for the United States. And I know I've been listening to you, and you're kind of like, you're not one of them Ron Paul guys, are you? But you know what? He really does have a good message.
Well, I don't know how often you listen to the show, but we've talked extensively about Ron Paul. And there are many things that I'm completely with you. In fact, I have somewhere here, and maybe I'll find it during the commercial break. It's 10 reasons not to vote for Ron Paul.
Maybe. Right.
So, you know, I would never vote for him, and the reasons are. In fact, this, if anyone is interested in this, and I know you're not, but if you go to Rochester Against War, you can find that list. I know you don't want, but for those who are interested, because I've had a lot of people say, you know, well, what about the fact he's against the drug war? He's against the war, you know, a lot of these things that do go in line with my ideals and many on the left. You know, I'm not a Democrat, much further left than that. Thank you very much. But, okay, so you're a Ron Paul guy. And okay, so I'll put the question to you then, John.
Yeah.
When Ron goes away, who will you turn to?
Well, there's a couple of good Democrats I like too.
See, I love this answer. This is beautiful.
I've always swung Democrat anyways, but you know what? The message Ron Paul had, I don't know if, you know, if he could actually, if he was able to pull it off, and I could vote for a Republican, which I've never done before. But I do like his meaning of a Republicacy. I like what he stands for on it. And if he could bring us back to, you know, hey, let's go back to the Constitution. Let's let's try to get our United States in order, and this idea of non-intervention overseas and stuff like that would be awesome.
I agree on that issue. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to take care of home first.
Let's do it. Okay, John. Yep. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling Night Call.
And you have an awesome night.
Hey, you too.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you to John. And standing by, here is Mike in Pontiac. Mike, welcome to the Night Call program. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. It's Julian. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to point out the fact that, a lot of countries always fight over natural resources. And, you know, we have a big dependency on oil and stuff. And it just points out how important it is for us to get off of our dependency of oil.
You mean alternative energy.
Absolutely. And, I mean, one of the other callers, I've been listening for a while, one of the other callers said, it's just countries fighting ever since the American Revolutionary War for natural resources and stuff. And if we can just use alternative energy a lot more, then there'd be nothing to really fight over.
Yeah, I'm with you big time. In fact, I did listen to part of Granholm's State of the State the other night, just part of it. And really, she was really focusing on, and let's hope this is going to come to fruition, on the state of Michigan being, getting better, improving, and putting a lot more money into alternative energy. In fact, she said something about Consumers Energy and DTE putting in millions and millions of dollars to make that happen. So let's hope we here in Michigan can be part of that, and I couldn't agree more. Anything else?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's another thing. About the candidates, it's kind of funny, that other guy, when you asked him what party he was with, he said, I guess I'm a Republican.
Yeah, he said, he didn't seem real proud of it, did he?
He didn't seem very proud of it.
Well, maybe he was afraid to say it to me.
Well, maybe. Well, I'm a Democrat, and I'm 25 years old. I've been to Iraq. And,
wow, really?
Didn't like it very much, yeah.
Didn't like it very much. I bet that's putting it lightly, Mike.
It is putting it lightly, but, there was someone that said that the media is trying to spin that only the Republicans are trusted with helping our economy.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And for me, that is the farthest possible thing from the truth.
It's because, the opposite.
Yeah, the only two presidents that I really remember well is Bill Clinton and the guy we got now, Bush Jr., I like to call him.
Yeah.
And Bush just did such a terrible job that there's my trust is completely gone out of anything that has to do with the Republican Party. There's just no way they could ever regain my trust.
Yeah.
You know, after such a, travesty
well,
of a presidency.
It's been absolutely disastrous all the way around.
So, I mean, if you want to put it one way or another, I'm definitely, going with the Democrats for the economy. You know, there's no doubt about it. And that's not to say that I'm like a Hillary supporter, because I don't really like some of the stuff that she does just to try and like for example, like when she's having her husband Bill Clinton kind of attack Obama so much, and I'm an Obama supporter, so
okay.
Like with her throwing punches and stuff like that, it really kind of like upsets me that she would just kind of go on the attack.
Yeah, well, they've been attacking each other pretty heftily back and forth. Obama's done his fair share, but did you see them in love, though, earlier this week?
What's that?
They were in love. It was almost like a beautiful fairy tale.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I actually didn't see that.
Yeah, it was at the last convention, and they were just all happy, dappy together, but it won't last. It's all a ruse.
Right.
But, I was going to say on the Clinton note that Bill Clinton is still out there, but they're kind of backing off from him a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to hear. But one last thing. if it happens to come down to, like, McCain versus, you know, either Hillary or Obama,
yeah.
You just got to hope to God that McCain doesn't get in to the presidency.
All right, hope to Gaia, hope to the Buddha, hope to whatever it is.
Hope to whoever that he doesn't get in the presidency. That guy is so vengeful when it comes to, like, going after Iran.
He's evil. He's absolutely evil. Thank you, Mike. I couldn't agree more. Have a great night. Thanks for calling Night Call.
All right, thank you.
All right. Good to hear from you. We'll take one call before we take a break, and it's Maurice, who's been waiting in Detroit. And here we are. Maurice, welcome to the program. Good to hear from you.
Hey, Julie, how you doing?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you.
Well, I called in 2 weeks to kind of make you mad, but you didn't give me a chance to finish.
Yeah, you did make me mad, by the way. I haven't forgotten it.
What I want to say, what is it going to take to get the economy back on its feet?
Well, a lot. How's that?
Well, okay,
maybe more than we have. But I let's start by cutting the defense budget, getting the troops out, and let's cut the defense budget, I'll say, in half. Peter Werbe would say more.
Hey, one more thing, Julie.
Yes, sir.
What I was trying to say, I worked with different people all around from different parts of the country, and how they treat their women is really unheard of, how we treat ours. And just going by that, I don't think that the person would give a female president the respect they would a man. That's the point I was trying to make 2 weeks ago.
I hear what you're saying, and I think that you're right, that there is a general lack of respect for women around the world. So, okay, thanks for clearing it up. Are we friends again?
I do. Just don't hang up on me again. Like, that'll be calling in.
Hey, by the way, I never hang up on anyone because Peter's the one who runs the board.
Oh.
I sit on the other side and hang out. It was him. He was mad at you because he's very protective of me, Maurice.
Hey, Julie, I met you before. You gave me a CD years ago.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not sure if I remember, but hey, thanks for bringing your topics up to the show. You've been a longtime listener, and you're forgiven.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll talk to you soon. We'll be back. We'll take your calls. We will take, let's see, next, we're going to go to Josh in Waterford, who is afraid of a woman president. This will be interesting. So, Josh, hang on the line. Nicole in Roseville. Mark in Roseville. Mike and Marco, hang on. We'll be right back. It's the Night Call program on 101 WRIF. Some open lines, 313-298-WRIF.
Weekday nights at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with the big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Yeah.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right. Thank you very much. Peter will be back next week. We'll let you know exactly where he was. But for this week, I can't tell you. He's looking forward to giving you all the information. I am, too. Looking forward to having him back. I'm Julian Jordan. Meanwhile, and coming up at 1 a.m., an interview with David Serrata about the stimulus package. Very interesting, with Peter, who will so sort of be here, right? Pre-recorded. And then at 1:30, Caroline Paul and Pearl Harbor. Thank you very much. I needed a pen. I don't know where I put that. A couple of emails coming in. Hi, Julian. The ruling elite want desperation. They want you to bow to their unholy union. They will try to get you to do it with fear. Fear not, Frank in Ann Arbor. G writes in, Julian, the last thing we need is some guy on the radio quoting the Bible. Let us not forget that G.W. Bush quotes the Bible and claims that God speaks through him and gives him guidance. So who is right? No one! You know, I'm not a Christian. I've said that on the air many times. And he was going to read three, okay? I gave him one out of respect, okay? I know there's a lot of wonderful Christians out there. Peter and I march alongside them at many, many protests around the country. And also many of my friends and loved ones are Christians as well. So no need to email me, okay? Also from Roderick, the male-female body. We're talking about the female president, which we're going to get back to the phones in just a flash, because there's a couple of people who do want to talk about that. Still, the male-female body is a body. There are some anatomical differences, but it is not the person. So anyway, I think Clinton can do the job, but she should do what we need done. This is what Roderick continues to say. Maybe these guys who are scared of women should go to the corner in Royal Oak next to Chosen Books and slip in noir leather and get some dominatrix equipment so the guys who get their fears out of themselves. Nothing wrong with a real hottie with handcuffs, right? Oh, my. Okay, just a few of the emails. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Thanks for that. 313-298-WRIF. We have full phone lines. And this is our final segment of the program, so we're going to get to those right away. Let's see. We said, who did we promise next? Josh in Waterford. That's right. He says he's afraid of a woman president. Josh, what's going on?
All right. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Afraid of a woman president isn't exactly what I meant to say. What I was going to say is, as far as all men being afraid of a woman in power, I think was crap. And just because if I personally don't like Hillary does not mean I don't want a woman president. I just think that this whole election's a joke, and it's all for what milestone do we want to break. It's not about who's going to be in power. And as far as what they're going to be able to do, they're not going to be able to do much other than picking up the pieces that Bush left and try to solve a puzzle.
The messy pieces, the complete mess, the disaster. I wouldn't wish that job on anyone.
They can't fix what he screwed up in 4 years.
You got that right. And this is, we're talking generations to come. We're talking your grandchildren will still be picking up the pieces from this mess.
Exactly. And it's not, I don't care. It doesn't matter what the president looked like.
Right.
You know, that has nothing to do with it. And that's the problem with this election, because that's what it seems like the whole election's about.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you know, and I agree with you. But I will say, as a woman, I know that there are men out there who don't quite know what to do with me. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, it's but the same thing goes, and I'm just playing the devil's advocate. There's the same thing that goes for women, and they just want to vote because Hillary's a girl.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you're not gonna.
That's the whole problem with it. Is we can't. The election
can't base it on gender or race.
The president of the United States cannot be about breaking a milestone or achieving some racial step.
Okay, but if either of them do win, it will be achieving some sort of milestone, and you know there will be a lot of women who are happy about that. I'm a feminist, and I don't want to vote for her.
That's exactly my point. I mean,
right. Yeah. Okay. So, well, let's vote with the issues and not with what your body parts are. Thanks, Josh.
Exactly.
Have a great one. Thanks for calling. Okay. Bye-bye. We go here to Nicole, who's in Roseville. Nicole, welcome to the Night Call program.
What's up, Q?
How you doing? You're
good.
Live on the air. No cursing.
I know. I won't. I love you. I've been listening for the past hour. I've had like 30,000 things to say.
I bet.
You know, about that one guy with like the, you know, I don't feel comfortable voting for a woman president and all that other malarkey.
Yep.
That's a good word.
That was a good choice.
But, you know, I was going to say also about the other guy talking about like the oil situation and everything. Well, you know what? 1974 is the last time they ever even, like, made a new oil refinery or, like, revamped any of ours. So actually, they, like, you know, our own country would take, you know, bonus and accountability of what they're doing. We wouldn't have a lot of problems. We wouldn't be bitching at other people about things like that.
Okay, and what else? What else bothered you today?
The other thing, oh, God, so much, like, the Bible quoting and all that other stuff. You know what? And it's not about breaking milestones, and it's not about this. It's just about, you know what, if you're a woman, if you're a minority, I mean, how can you not vote for something that's standing up for your rights in general? I mean, I have a preference, obviously, but, I mean, I'm not going to vote for Hillary, but, I mean, I have a preference, and I just think that people should just vote with, you know, it's in the best interest for them, besides, you know, religious aspects, besides this, besides that, just what's good their own interest, instead of getting all, like, you know, oh, well, you know, I don't like this, I don't like that.
Yeah, and what's in the best interest for the country, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. you're the individual is the country, so, you know what I mean?
Yeah. We are the world, Nicole. All right, thanks for calling in. Good
you.
To hear from you. And
you.
Back at you. All right.
Bye-bye.
And let's see. One open line if you want to get in. I'm going to cruise on through these phone calls. Marco has been waiting for a little while, so we'll take his call next. Marco, welcome to Night Call. You're on 101 WRIF. I'm Julene.
Hello, Julene. Nice to meet you.
You too?
I'm not a Republican or Democrat.
Me neither.
I'm an American citizen.
High five, brother.
All right. I mean, just like George Washington, you know, Benjamin Franklin, Reagan, Kennedy. I mean, these are all people who are just interested in America just being a good country, making us good, decent people.
I don't know about Reagan.
But everybody. Well, he tried.
Okay.
And that's my point is, can any man really govern flawlessly? When you think about it, even through history.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, but I wonder, really, really, do you really think any of these cats and kitties have any really good intentions for the country?
Yeah, I think they do have
you
good
do?
Intentions.
Who?
But their way about it is they're all different. It doesn't matter what kind of candidate, they all have good intentions, I think they do.
I think they all have good intentions to get elected.
Yeah, but, I mean, they go through a lot of trouble. I mean, they could make a lot more money, have an easy life without going through candidacy and all that stuff.
God, I would never do it. I no way.
Well, I wouldn't either.
Yeah.
I mean, but
well, I couldn't. I have too many skeletons in my closet. Don't we all?
Yeah. I know you mentioned earlier, you know, with the previous callers, you know, about, you know, the bad nature of, you know, the current administration, you know, their tactics.
But I think my word was disastrous, yeah.
Okay. And how, you know, someone mentioned how they should be accountable to war crimes. I mean, we could take that all the way back to, you know, our founding fathers of this country. You know, with this country doesn't belong to any of us. Most of us are European. This belongs to the Native Americans.
Oh, I could not agree with you more.
And, you know, then we step a little bit further in history, and you have World War II dropping the atom bomb on Japan. I mean, is that a good call?
Exactly.
Who's to say?
It's a very good question, Marco. And so what do you think you're going to do? Would you vote for Hillary if she were the only choice?
Let me put it to you this way. I remember in the 90s, because someone said, you know, terrorism started in 9/11 for the U.S. It did not start 9/11. In the early 90s, they tried to blow up the Twin Towers, if you recall.
Yep.
I remember in the late 90s, it was during the Clinton administration, USS Cole got bombed.
Yeah.
What was done about that? Nothing. I remember seeing that on TV. I was like, Dad, we're going to war. Nothing happened.
And you agree with me that things are worse than ever, and we really should be.
Yeah.
More terrified than ever. I mean, I'm even considering, and I never did this, get one of those, get your water and your, you know, your pantry goods and things like that. I'm even considering doing this.
My brother, he turned into a survivalist. He's rubbing off on me a little bit.
Jeez. Well, hey, listen, if crap hits the fan, will you call me and we can go hang with your brother?
He doesn't. He has an undisclosed location.
Okay, well, tell him there's a talk show host who wants safety if the time comes, okay?
Well, you know, I'd rather have a president that acts too strong than too weak. That's my point.
Well, okay, Marco, thanks for calling the Night Call program, and you have a great night and a great week. Okay, hang in there, as we all are doing our best to do. Let's see, who's been waiting the next longest? Oh, we'll take Mike's call. I'm not sure exactly where Mike is calling from. Mike, where are you?
I'm calling from Manistee, Michigan.
Oh, well, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I was calling to talk about NAFTA and sound money.
Okay, so you're a Ron Paul supporter, and he's against NAFTA, and so am I.
Uh-huh. And what other candidates are against NAFTA and having sound money?
Well, Kucinich was it, and at this point, you know. But let's talk about some other Ron Paul things. You know, he would deny a woman control of her body, which I can't do. He would be disastrous for the working class. His tax plan is simply unfair to lower earners and people who would greatly benefit, with the highest incomes, of course. I say he doesn't care about the environment like I'd like for him to care about. He's kind of a gun nut, and I'm not, and I don't want to get the gun people going, okay? He's opposed to the separation of church and state. I'm sorry I can't go there, Mike.
No.
I can't go there.
It's better for the... for the economy.
I don't know.
About this sound
I don't agree. I don't agree. But
their dollar should be backed by gold and silver.
Okay. The economy is in the tank because of what George W. Bush has done, and I don't think that those two things are going to save it. And you know what? He just suggested, and I still haven't gotten to this, and the show is about 10 minutes from being over. I hate to say that, Mike, but it's the first ever $3 trillion budget that Bush is seeking. This is what he wants to seal his legacy as resident of the United States. The $3 trillion budget proposal. He has hit a new milestone, breaking records all over the place. Mike, thanks for calling.
Yeah, too bad it's not 3 trillion feathers. It would be worth a lot more.
Okay. Or feathers. Okay. Widgets. Whatever. All right. Thank you for calling. We appreciate you calling into the Night Call program. We don't just pick people who think like us to be on the air, but oftentimes they do, like Alan Inkster. I think he does.
Think I do what?
I think that, were you not listening?
No, actually. I wasn't.
Okay. I said I think you think like us. Like Peter, like me.
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah, you're kind of on our side, right?
Yeah, I've always been to the left.
Oh, right. Okay, I should say. You want to talk about people who are afraid of women or a woman president?
Of a woman president.
Okay.
I've heard guys that I work with going, oh, no woman can be tough enough to be president. And I'm like, well, they're tough enough to give birth to you.
Thank you.
You know?
Thank you.
And having been somebody who worked out of doors for a long time, I've always been more afraid to tangle with the female of the species than the male.
You should be. And okay, so when you say the give birth thing, I've never done it. I don't plan on doing it. It's just not in my plan of action, okay? But so for all of you, all you guys watch football, we give birth to them, okay? Thank you. Thank you. That's my little big game.
One last point I'd like to make is if Hillary does win,
yeah.
If Hillary does win, that's going to mean two families have played predominant roles in the White House during my entire adult life.
Bush Co. and Clinton Co., huh?
That's right.
Yeah, I hear you, Al. Thanks for calling. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yep.
Okay. Good night. Good night. Take a few more calls. We're going to get as many of these as we can. Let's go to Ontario and talk to Eric. He called 313-298-WRIF. Eric, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
I'm doing just great.
I have it up. My wife's American, and when Bush first ran for president,
mm-hmm.
I was a supporter of him because I figured the last thing he'd do is go into Iraq. I figured he wouldn't, because the only people that benefit from that is a certain country that's in the Middle East, and they're the ones that are most interested if Iraq was taken out. But I have a feeling that the Republicans have set up the situation. Like, it's easy to say, yeah, we America should have never gone in there, and they should get out of there. But now that they are in there, I don't think you guys could withstand them walking out of there with, you know, their tail between the legs. It just wouldn't look good to them. It would kind of be another Vietnam stuck in their face that they really don't need. And I got a feeling that if the Democrats do get to, you know, in as the president, no matter what they do, they're going to look, they're not going to be able to pull America out of there gracefully. And, you know, they're not going to maybe last one term at most, because they're not going to be able to do what the American people really want.
Yeah, graceful would definitely be the last word I would use in any part of Iraq, going in, being there, or getting out. I think that though we really should think about getting these troops out of there.
Yeah, that is a consideration, but
like now,
you have lost 4,000 troops.
Yeah,
to just pull out of there wouldn't be very good either.
Well, I don't have an answer. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Respectfulness, you know what I mean?
Right, Eric. I definitely don't have all the answers. I mean, you know what? I am a political activist, I am a political junkie, and I am an entertainer. I don't have all the answers. And I definitely know, if you checked out Bush's State of the Union, which I did not watch, but I read the transcript, he doesn't know what the hell to do either. But Eric, thanks for calling in from Ontario. Appreciate
okay,
you making our show
have a nice night.
International, as Peter always says. Try to keep things a little bit the same while he's gone. He will be back next week, and he's looking forward to being back on the air. I'm looking forward to having him. Let's go back to Canada. Rob is in Windsor. Hi.
Hi, Julian. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
That last caller from Ontario, he pretty much echoed some of my thoughts, but being Canadian, I'm not really supposed to influence your elections in any way, shape, or form. But I can tell you from experience on our side over here,
yeah,
we've had 13 years of a Liberal government, and it has been nothing but scandal after scandal after scandal. So when you say vile right-wingers, it's kind of offensive to me a little bit. I respect your right to say that.
Oh, I'm sure it is. You know, we're very sensationalist, we talk show hosts.
Yes, but, you know, actually, we've had some pretty vile left-wingers over here. And actually, since we've had our conservative government now for a couple of years,
yeah,
Mr. Stephen Harper, things have been actually pretty good. And I value good relations with my U.S. brothers. I have a lot of family and friends over there. And I seem to see your elections going Democratic, and because a lot of people don't like Bush.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when 9/11 happened, it seemed like everyone was united and there was no left and there was no right. And
But that's not true. It's not true. It seemed that way. Maybe did you get that? Would you say you got that from watching the media? From watching American media?
Well, talking to friends and all
okay.
that over there.
And yeah, because everyone, see, there were the sheeple were there. I was never there. Not for a second. Not for 1 second was I ever for this. And Peter and I had a nationally syndicated show. Sorry to keep cutting you off, Rob, but I got to say this. Peter and I had a nationally syndicated show at that time. And we were taken off of, within the first month, 20 affiliates around the country because we said Bush is a liar. And now all of those people are with us.
Well, you know, like I said, I mean, I don't really, I like George Bush in the beginning. I know you guys, you know, your thoughts of him and all that. And I don't know. It seems to me like you guys are going to go hard left this time around. And I don't see the will in the left to finish what needs to be finished. And the last point I want to make is to win a war, for whatever reason it started, you have to learn to be more lethal than your enemy. And that's what has not been done in the past few wars that have been conducted, because your enemy is willing to be more lethal than you. And that's just my thoughts on the matter.
Okay, Rob.
It may sound like hard right wing, but...
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree less once again. But thanks you for calling in, because all opinions are welcome here on the Night Call program. And winning, I just don't understand that term either. Winning what? and we are way more lethal. We've killed hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqi civilians, men, women, and children, blown their brains out. So I say we're a little bit more lethal than they are. Let's go to Toledo and talk to Jeff. Jeff,
hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Thank
nice
you.
To talk to you again. Oh, wow, a right-wing Canadian. That's crazy.
I know.
Anyway, well,
who would have thunk it?
Right, Canadian right-wing government people, they are not anywhere near the same as American right-wing versus left-wing.
Okay.
They don't have that whole religious connotation going on there.
Yeah.
I don't think he... Well, anyway, what I really wanted to talk about was, you know, I talked to you... That was quite a while ago, and I don't know if you remember, but I said John McCain was crazy like a fox.
He is crazy.
Right, but like a fox. Now, just hear me out.
Okay.
I told you that, and you're like, oh, you know, he's just crazy. He's talking all this crazy stuff. You know, he's back in the right wing's pocketbook. You know,
are you quoting me?
I am.
Okay.
But listen, I said he has to do that. He's very close to the Clintons. He's very close to them. And Ann Coulter... just proved my point.
Yeah, did you hear me? Oh,
yes,
you heard me say that.
I heard her do it. And she came out in the media and proved my point. She said that because they are terrified.
And what we're talking about here, Jeff in Toledo is on the line, is that Ann Coulter, that very, very frightening woman who goes on television and is so scary and thinks all liberals should be wiped off the planet, said that if McCain were the nominee, she would vote for Hillary.
Campaign for her.
Campaign for her.
Right.
Thank you.
And this is the thing. She just came out and gave away the plan that's behind the scenes. See, everybody believes what they see on the tube. And they go,
of course.
They go with what they're seeing there, but that's not what's happening. What's really happening is you have this. You have Karl Rove and the right-wing fascists trying to complete the wiping out of this free country.
Yeah.
And on the other side, you have the Clinton team who is... more sane, more progressive, and they're trying. This is what's at stake here, folks. You know, what's really at stake is an attempted right-wing religious takeover of the nation.
Please don't let it happen.
No, right, and the Clintons are there to stop that from happening.
Okay.
John McCain is put in there as a fail-safe. On the Republican side.
Ooh, are you a conspiracy kind of guy?
No, I'm telling you.
All right.
And they hate John McCain on the far right because they know this.
Mm.
They know that if he wins the nomination, okay, he is going to try to undo all of this crap that these crazies...
Right.
Who are packed in the executive branch,
yeah.
And they are stripping
everything, yeah.
So that the executive branch is basically the dictatorship of the nation.
Couldn't agree more. Jeff, I have to let you go.
Okay.
I want to let you finish, but I've got three calls I got to get in about
great.
2 minutes.
Thanks
for calling. Take
Bye.
Care. And we are going to breeze through these. Al, I know I'm watching my time, I promise. So let's go to John in Lincoln Park. You have about 30 seconds, John. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing tonight?
Doing fine.
I had called earlier, and I kind of got off on a different tangent.
Oh, were you already on? You know what? You got to call back next week, because
yeah.
I got to get to Henry in Windsor. I'm so sorry to do this to you. Please don't hate me. Please don't email me. Henry is in Windsor. Real quick, you're our final call for the night. Henry, you have about 30 seconds.
How you doing?
Great.
I got kind of a bone to pick with your callers, but I have basically a general premise that I want to give some advice to. Anybody with an internet connection can go online and find out what these candidates are really about. So for a lot of these callers are calling in saying, oh, Bill Clinton was great for the economy. And I mean, anybody with any history and an internet connection can find out he is the one who signed the Chinese Free Trade Agreement, sending Michigan jobs overseas. So
he did a lot of bad.
I'm sorry?
He did a lot of bad as well, you bet.
I mean, I would just, instead of, you know, believing what other people believe and being sheeple, I would, like you say, sheeple.
Yes.
I would just give some advice that just go online. You can even go to their official websites. They pretty much will tell you what their positions are.
Yeah.
Instead of believing other people, what other people are telling you what their positions are.
Or watching CNN and getting it from there,
oh,
right?
Oh, that's the worst thing you can do.
God, don't do it. Don't do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying inform yourselves.
Just inform yourself because some of your callers are coming in with some very strange facts.
Oh, yes.
I would recommend them doing some research before they vote. Yes, another point I wanted to make, Ron Paul, you mentioned Ron Paul, 10 worst reasons why you wouldn't vote for Ron Paul. I couldn't find that on Rochester. I guess.
Oh, you couldn't? Okay, if you email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com, I will forward it to you. How's that sound?
Sure, but the thing is, I see some of the points against him. I definitely wouldn't, if I was married, I wouldn't vote for him.
Yeah.
But then again, I wouldn't vote for any of them.
I know, but it's scary.
His bad points probably are outweighed by his good points, I would think, as an opinion.
I agree, Henry. Thank you for calling. Thank you for calling. Okay, that's it. Henry is our final caller of the night. I'm Julene Jordan. It's been wonderful being here with you. Peter Werby will be back next week, as will I. We'll tell you where he was and just exactly what he was up to. Go out and vote Super Tuesday for those of you listening online around the country. And peace.
You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. It's a pleasure also to bring back someone who's been on the broadcast before. It's David Sirota. He is an author, columnist, and journalist. He is headquartered in Denver, and he's one of the guys that does the heavy lifting for me, probably without even knowing it. In other words, he looks at everything so close and comes up with some great ideas, so then I just read those, and sometimes I attribute them, but sometimes I just use them as general information. David Sirota, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
Are you mad because I steal your stuff?
Oh, no. Please do. Please do.
I know. I'm only kidding. You know, I was going to, and I think we still will, talk about your recently released column, The Stimulus Swindle. But as I went to your site, davidsirota.com, which is S-I-R-O-T-A, davidsirota.com, I see that you're bringing out a book called The Uprising, an unauthorized tour, the populist revolt scaring Wall Street and Washington. That's going to be out at the end of May. And so we're going to have you back on that one for absolute sure. But is there a tie-in in some ways? Because most people think, oh, you know, it's the horrible Republicans that have screwed up everything with the war and the economy, and then the tepid, ineffective Democrats. And those are our two choices, Tweedledee and Tweedledummer, depending on, you know, who you see as the dumber. So is there a connection between what's going on now and what you've written about in your book?
Yes, absolutely. I think that what I've written about in my book, which is a I wouldn't call it a full-fledged movement, but certainly a ferment out there that is being organized in many different disparate ways. It's being organized against what's going on right now, and I think the stimulus package is a good example of what is being of what people are organizing against. You know, we've got a serious economic crisis going on. It's been going on actually for quite a long time. I mean, everyone's all of us, you know, suddenly talking about a stimulus package, but most people out there know, especially folks in Michigan, know that that the economy's been doing pretty badly for a while, and the politicians in Washington seem to be using the crisis as just an excuse to do the same kind of thing, only more quickly and more intensely. More specifically, the stimulus package, as it's being discussed right now, is primarily made up of business tax cuts, corporate tax cuts. It's all tax cuts, which I think is pretty bad. But most of, or at least half of, the tax cuts are specifically corporate and business tax cuts.
Wait a minute. I thought it was like $100 billion for the common folks, uses, and $50 billion for business.
Well, you know, the estimates keep changing. Initially it was that it was going to be $70 to $80 billion in business tax cuts and about $70 to $60 billion in rebates. So they're, in fairness, they are still debating this. But the point is this: why is such a large chunk of the stimulus even being talked about being given to corporate America? I'm not saying that corporate America doesn't need some help right now, but the people who are really on the economic brink are people who are losing their jobs, who've seen their wages cut, who can't afford health care, who've seen their pensions raided, and also importantly is that when you pass a bill that's mostly tax cuts, and specifically that has a large chunk that's business tax cuts, that's not the quickest way to get the money into the economy. I mean, economists on both sides of the aisle will tell you that the quickest way to get money into the economy is to increase unemployment benefits, increase food stamps, and increase investments very quickly in public infrastructure spending. And by the way, doing that accomplishes more than just the goal of getting money into the economy. You know, if you increase unemployment benefits and food stamps, you're helping people who are right at the economic brink. If you increase a public investment spending on infrastructure, roads, bridges, that kind of thing, you're building your economy for the long term. The tax cuts as they exist right now just put money into the economy, but they don't create any long-lasting benefits for the rest of the economy.
Now, the stereotype of the two major parties are that the Republicans are the friend of big business. So you can understand why George Bush suggested, or I shouldn't say suggested, got passed in the House, a bill that primarily is about, as you're saying, focused around tax cuts for business. But the Democratic Party supposedly is the friend, the advocate of the common man and woman, the middle class and the working class and the poor. Why did Nancy Pelosi sign on to this?
That's a very, very good question. I have no answer for it. It doesn't make any sense to me as to why the Democrats didn't just simply pass a bill through the House and then hopefully through the Senate that was more stimulative for the economy and better for working people, and simply make George Bush sign the bill. This is part and parcel of the Democratic Party in the new Congress. I mean, this is not shocking. It seems that no matter how low George Bush's poll approval ratings go,
whatever demands he asks for, the Democrats are willing to meet him. And I think that that's just really, why is that? I think, sure, it's part of it that the Democratic Party still doesn't really know what it stands for. I mean, it won election in 2006 not based on any real agenda that it campaigned for. It won because the Republicans in many ways lost. I think it's also that the Democratic Party is still afraid of George Bush for whatever reason. So there's multiple factors going on here. But I do think you're right. It's a missed opportunity.
Well, what do you think about the argument in so many aspects of the Democrats' timidity, or what appears to be timid behavior in front of George Bush about the war and numerous other pieces of legislation, that they can barely squeak through because the Republicans still remain so united in the main, where the Democrats are always all over the place, but that if they squeak legislation through, like something that would have been more expansive, like you were mentioning, David Sirota, like increased unemployment benefits, food stamps, that stimulus that's mostly aimed at the middle and the working class, get that money into the economy. They could have passed it in the House. They may have passed it in the Senate, but George Bush would veto it, and then they wouldn't have enough votes to overcome the veto.
I just don't tend to look that far ahead. I think politics changes all the time. I mean, sure, George Bush might veto a bill that he doesn't like, but the pressure system changes after a bill passes potentially. I've learned that in politics you can't really foresee the future or predict the future. You have to go with what's right and do what's right in the moment. So I think that sort of setting up this conception that, oh, George Bush is going to veto everything, so why pass anything? Well, you can use that excuse for everything. And especially on economic issues, I think he'd be really hard pressed to veto a bill. And again, I wouldn't put it past him, but I think it would be very, very tough for him to veto a bill that passed through the Congress on a bipartisan basis that was much different from this and actually would help working people and would more quickly stimulate the economy. I mean, I don't put it past him, but I definitely think that I don't think he wants to go out as the next Herbert Hoover, although yeah. I don't know if he can avoid that now, of course.
Well, I know. There's already what they used to call in the early 30s, as I know you know, Hoovervilles, these sort of permanent homeless establishments that people have been building or built back in the 30s outside of big cities, shacks, and now they're starting to appear in the same place in California as well. So maybe he deserves the mantle. But in any event, the bill you would have thought would have had something for seniors on Social Security, just in terms of understanding what a powerful electoral base that is, and yet nothing there as well. So it's moved to the Senate now, and Democratic senators are talking about inserting more of what we were just talking about. Do you think that's got a chance to pass?
I think it might have a chance to pass. I think that Republicans, they're running away from George Bush. I think that that's an opportunity for Democrats. I think hopefully appealing to Bush's idea that he doesn't want to go out as the next Herbert Hoover. I mean, maybe that's not in his thinking. Probably isn't. That's probably right. But I just think that the Democrats have been too willing to foresee political peril or legislative obstacles and use that view that they see as a reason not to do anything.
David Sirota is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. You can go to David Sirota, SIROTA.com, and see his latest column called The Stimulus Swindle. Tell us some, this is amazing, and you mentioned this in your column, about the role of Citigroup in this whole process, and the Democrats, no less.
Yeah, this is really stunning. The Washington Post reported, it was about a week ago, that at the hearings to discuss what should go in the stimulus, that the Senate Finance Committee, led by Max Baucus of Montana, a Democrat, asked two economists, both from the Hamilton Project, which is a think tank that is sponsored and run by Robert Rubin, the CEO now of Citigroup. Citigroup is the bank that was at one of the center pieces in this financial crisis, this meltdown. They asked Citigroup, these Citigroup affiliated economists to testify and provide input into the stimulus, but they didn't, they actually excluded labor economists. And so not surprisingly, the package that comes out, in this deal between Democrats and the Bush White House, at least rhetorically, the package is all tax cuts. It has none of the priorities really for working people. Now again, that may change as the bill moves through the Senate, and amendments are brought up. But it was just a sort of a stunning admission about who Congress and who the Democratic Party listens to.
Well, in terms of listening to who either party or both parties listen to, of course, a lot of it is based, some of it's ideological, particularly on the part of the Republicans, but on both parties it has to do with who's going to finance their campaigns. And if, I mean, think about the substantive platforms of Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul, neither of which could barely move the needle because of their inability to attract large amounts of money needed for advertising and the rest of it goes into these primary campaigns. So I get the feeling the Democrats think, well, this is all going to drop into our lap, and we're seeing all this big corporate money begin to shift to the Democrats now for the election campaign. We don't want to rock the boat right when the boat needs rocking.
You're absolutely right. I think it was Bob Reich, the former Clinton Labor Secretary, who said, you know, the stimulus package is supposed to be about raising the economy, and instead he fears that it's going to be about raising campaign contributions. I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, the amount of corporate cash now going into the Democratic Party, going into many of the, you know, the major presidential candidates, coffers. You know, Hillary Clinton's the top recipient of healthcare industry cash. Barack Obama's the top recipient of Wall Street cash. I mean, it's just, it is really obscene. And it's obscene for how it plays out in terms of real policies that affect real Americans. When you have that kind of campaign finance situation happening, you're going to get a stimulus package that gives a huge chunk of taxpayer cash to corporations in the form of tax cuts. You're not going to have a stimulus package that pays much attention to working people. That's how that campaign finance corruption really affects ordinary people.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, it's a conundrum, because if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama were to refuse that corporate funding, they'd probably be down around the poll numbers of Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is the question of John Edwards. His campaign, people have asked, well, why hasn't he done better? Well, when you get outspent, $200 million to whatever small amount of money he's raised, you're going to probably have a tough time winning. And you're probably going to have a tough time raising more money if you're talking about issues of corporate power, corporate greed. Same thing for Kucinich and Ron Paul. You know, the problem is we have a campaign finance system that quite literally selects against candidates who talk about the most fundamental economic issues that most people know are at the center of our economic problems.
Yeah, I mentioned Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich for a number of reasons, one of which, if there was an authentic campaign based on the politics and the aspirations currently of the American people, those would be the two candidates. Because in issues like the war, the economy, the Patriot Act, the NAFTA and WTO, there's agreement across the board with the Americans that those all are bad. And then when you start getting down into social issues, then where you have this divergence between a right-wing view of Paul and a left-wing view of Dennis Kucinich. But that'd be the real issues. But it's all going to be bumper sticker and lawn signs saying change, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's... You know, the substance has really been buried in this current presidential debate. You know, everyone's talking about change. You know, if you just listen to what the candidates were saying, everybody's for change. You know, I mean, it's almost insulting. And it's actually quite sad, because it's hard to really discern where the real differences are between any of these candidates. And frankly, there's in many ways really not a lot of differences in a lot of the remaining candidates, which is, you know, a predictable, I think tragic, because the country, I think, is more ready for change. change, for real change, than it has been in many years. The media hasn't helped, of course. You know, the media is playing all into this. The Democratic primary has become this ridiculous high school feud between, you know, essentially two candidates who are substantively almost exactly the same. They both get huge amounts of corporate money. Neither of them really wants to talk very much about corporate power, corporate greed, economic inequality. So, you know, it's definitely a tragedy at that level. But I also think that the good thing is that, as I describe in my upcoming book, you know, there is an independent movement building against this kind of thing. And I think that, you know, you don't really get change in the United States without a really vibrant, strong, independent movement. And by independent, I mean a movement that isn't based on one candidate or one cult of personality or even one party, a movement that's based on an ideology. And I think that that's starting to happen, and I think that that it's going to take some time for that movement to build, but I think that really, to me, is the most encouraging thing about what's going on.
Sure, and if people aren't exactly clear, because you said that in broad and general terms, we're talking specifically about how this country was founded on a revolutionary movement. We're talking about the abolitionist movement, the women's suffrage movement, the anti-war and labor movement before World War I, the union movement of the 1930s, all the movements of the 1950s and 1960s. That's what pushed the change in this country, and that kind of corny bumper sticker that says, if the people lead, the leaders will follow.
That's exactly right. That to me, that was what was so insulting, by the way, about Hillary Clinton's comments about the civil rights movement. She made a flippant comment a couple of weeks ago where she said that that Dr. Martin Luther King was a great leader, but the Civil Rights Act was passed by Lyndon Johnson, the president. Which, I mean, technically it's true. The thrust of the comment, though, implies that what brings change is a politician in Washington, and that is not true. The last people to bring change are politicians in Washington. Politicians are forced out of political expediency to make the changes that that people are demanding that they make. And I think that worldview by Clinton, it does actually represent a substantial difference between her and Obama. I actually do believe that Barack Obama, whether he's similar to Clinton on many substantive policy issues or not, I do believe that he understands that change doesn't come only from a president individually. That a president is ultimately able to push and move change if they have a groundswell of support, public support, underneath them. I think Hillary Clinton doesn't really truly appreciate that. She thinks that this race is all about her and her husband. And you know, I think that's why if people are wavering about who to support, I think that's a very important thing for people to appreciate and understand, because that does represent one of the few major overarching differences between these two candidates.
Yeah, and someone asked me, so would you really vote for Hillary? And I said, well, it'd probably be about third or fourth political thing I would do that day. And the majority of it, hopefully, would be involved in building the kind of uprising, which is the title of your upcoming book, David Sirota. And they said, why? And I said, well, if it's the lesser of the two evils, I'd rather have the lesser than the greater of the two evils in. And there's not an enormous gulf between, say, John McCain and Hillary Clinton. There are, but not like there was, say, between, I don't know, what are some of those guys that dropped out, like Turcato? I can't even remember what the hell his name was. But it wasn't, isn't he from Colorado?
That's right. And I should say, you know, but John McCain poses an interesting quandary. You know, I am not a supporter of John McCain. I think he's been terrible on a lot of issues.
Sure.
He's been terrible on the war. But I will give him this. You know, he has the right enemies, meaning that the Republican country club establishment really, really doesn't like him. And he has, on occasion, stood up and taken courageous stands for a Republican on issues of campaign finance, on the Bush tax cuts. And to me, you know, I find that intriguing, and I think that is going to be why he's going to be, if he is the general election nominee for the Republicans, I think that's why he's going to be such a difficult candidate for the Democrats to beat.
Yeah, he's their worst nightmare, and I guess Hillary is probably the McCain is the Democrats' worst nightmare, maybe the Republicans too. But and Hillary is the Republicans' dream, right? They would.
But the Hillary McCain matchup, I think, is. I mean, it would be. Now there's the Republican establishment doesn't like McCain, but I think for Republican partisans who only care about the Republican Party winning, regardless of what those candidates represent, I definitely think that a McCain-Hillary matchup is exactly they couldn't dream of a better matchup within the current crop of candidates.
Is that the way you think it's going to come down, David Sirota, or is it going to be Obama, or is it too early to tell?
I really can't tell. It's really, really difficult to tell. I go back and forth on what I think is going to happen. I definitely would you know, my worst nightmare, of course, is it ends up being Hillary versus Romney. You know, two candidates that I have trouble finding almost any redeeming qualities about as candidates. Hillary Clinton, John McCain contest, you know, I think at least then there would be a potential dynamic for at least a good debate, at least, you know, as opposed to just a straight up partisan slugfest. You know, McCain poses different challenges that will make Hillary adapt potentially in different ways that would be potentially good. You know, a Romney Hillary Clinton matchup would just be the same old Republican versus Democratic loggerhead kind of contest, which won't, I think, move the country forward.
Now, actually, given their friendship, McCain and Clinton, they might actually be civil.
I think it might be civil. And again, I think that McCain's actions on issues like campaign finance reform, global warming, opposing the Bush tax cuts, will force potentially Hillary Clinton to take even more progressive positions on those issues to try to outflank him. And I think that dynamic would be good. As I said, I think a Clinton-Romney contest would just be the same old kind of thing, just a partisan trench warfare, you know, war of attrition that I don't think would move the country forward.
Yeah, understanding that labels are always difficult, I would put you and I in what's called, at least among the general punditry, on the progressive left. And it's people like you and I who, when you say Hillary, we don't start smiling. Do you think that this that much of the progressive left would just say, you know, I'm staying home? That's
it's hard to say. I mean, it's hard to say where McCain would repackage himself and try to appeal to some of that base, and where he would dig in. It's possible that he would dig in on the war so extremely that it would galvanize the anti-war movement. Now. It's hard to imagine the anti-war movement being galvanized behind Hillary Clinton, who helped lead the country into war. But, you know, odder things have happened. It's hard to predict. I definitely think there is that risk of a depressed turnout among base Democratic voters if that was the contest. But you just never know.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with me. David Sirota, author, columnist, and journalist. And David has a brand-new book coming out at the end of May. It's called The Uprising, an Unauthorized Tour of the Populist Revolt, Scaring Wall Street in Washington. Wouldn't we all love that? That not only scare them, make them do something different, and that's what it's really all about. David's website is David Sirota, that's SIROTA.com. I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and you can pre-order The Uprising as well, and you can find all that information at David's site. David Sirota, once again, thanks for having joined me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me.
This is WRIM.com.
I know.
we're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Most of us, when we think about Hawaii, think about what? What a great place for a vacation. Either we've been there or we'd like to go there. It's pretty far from Detroit, but, hey, the flights go there. A lot of people I know have visited there. It's a fine place to vacation. The other darker side of it, of course, is the day that will live in infamy, December 7th, 1941, when a Japanese Air Force attacked Pearl Harbor. I have right here an extraordinarily interesting book. It's called East Wind Rain, and it is written by Caroline Paul. It's published by Morrow, and Caroline Paul is the author of Fighting Fire. That was a memoir of her years as a member of the San Francisco Fire Department's elite rescue squad. She lives in the Bay Area. We're talking to her there. And she's a member of the Writer's Grotto, which we may talk about later if we get the time. Right now, it's a pleasure to introduce Caroline Paul, and welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Now, this novel, which is about a crash landing of a Japanese pilot onto an outlying Hawaiian island following the attack on Pearl Harbor, this is directly rooted in history. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's actually the book, East Wind Rain, is a novel, but I actually follow very, very closely a true story, a kind of absurd true story that very few people have heard of. In fact, I asked military historians about this little anecdote that I had heard from somebody from Hawaii, that basically they said, oh, there was a Japanese pilot who, after attacking Pearl Harbor, had to ditch his plane and crash-landed on this little isolated island where nobody knew what had happened on Pearl Harbor. And so I was so fascinated. The result is a book about the 7 days that he was on this island called Niihau.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more about how you found out about it.
It's basically a friend handed me a very small book that was about 60 pages long, written by a kind of a Hawaii buff and a military buff. And he did incredible research. And that was the first book I read. And initially I thought I was going to be fascinated by the book, but by the story, because it has such an incredible beginning. You know, a plane out of the sky drops onto a little island, and you know, the collision goes from there in a lot of ways. The people, you know, the emotionally. But in fact, as the story unfolded, it just got more and more absurd, and I couldn't believe it was true. And so from then on, I went to the public library and did research and talked to people, and this is what I have.
Now, you have a cast of characters here, and either all of them or almost all of them are real people, ones that lived on that island and took part in what you detail in East Wind Rain, right?
Yeah, actually, almost every single character. I would say all the major characters, actually, the names and hopefully their personalities are the people that lived on this island or were somehow involved in this event. You know, it's unfortunate. I couldn't find very much archival material at all. So I did my best to try to flesh out these characters without a lot of information. And I'll tell you that I don't know if this is good or bad, but if the people are dead, you're actually allowed to say anything you want about them if you use their name, which I find, you know, that's a big responsibility.
Sure.
So I really wanted to try to do them justice.
Now, in any novel, of course, there's, not necessarily, but very frequently, particularly with the subject matter, something following this day that will live in infamy, the attack on Pearl Harbor, there has to be a lot of moral and ethical decisions, good people and bad people. And since these were actually people who had lived, how did you make the decision as to what to assign to their particular characters?
Well, let me first explain a little bit about Niihau to give people just an idea of how incredible this story is. Niihau is a little island, and this is true, off Kauai, about 16 miles to the west. It's the last Hawaiian island, and it happens to be privately owned by a family who bought it from King Kamehameha in 1864. And they're really very Christian, and they keep the island very, very isolated, perhaps as a result of their Christianity. Well, there were a lot of people who wondered why they did keep it so isolated, perhaps for nefarious reasons, like, you know, good cheap labor. But the people who lived on it were Hawaiian, almost exclusively. And the Robinson family, who owned this island, didn't allow, at the time, in the 1940s, didn't allow radios, electricity, cars, post office. There was really very little contact with the outside world. So as a result, when this Zero, this Japanese fighter plane, crashed on the island and the pilot lived, they had no idea what had happened. There was, however, one Japanese-American couple on the island, and they did know. They figured it out because they spoke Japanese. And so what I have here is just a cast of really interesting characters who really, nobody's good or bad. You know, I didn't want to make it such an easy assignation like the pilot, the Japanese pilot is bad and the Hawaiians are good. It doesn't really work that way, especially on this island, because once you're on this island, I think you really are isolated from the rest of the world and all their morals about, you know, the good guys and the bad guys.
Yeah. Now, the status of Hawaii itself, it didn't become a state till 1959, and it was the last state, the 50th state. How did Hawaii wind up to be anything connected to the United States? It was originally a kingdom, am I correct?
Yes, it was. It was a monarchy until the late 1800s. And at about the, I mean, the whites or Haoles or foreigners had been coming, and really the foreigners were mostly white until they started having you know, immigrants from Asian companies in countries in order to farm the fields of sugar and pineapple. But so basically, I'll say Haoles, which means white person, and kind of loosely foreigner. Well, the Haoles had come. You know, they'd come on the whaling ships, then they came as missionaries, and then finally the second generation of missionaries really became landowners and big business. And they were really concerned that the monarchy was getting a little too uppity and, you know, wasn't, the natives weren't controllable, basically. And so they looked to the United States to perhaps, you know, oversee the situation. The second thing that they did is that the United States at the time had taxed the sugar in a way that wasn't at all favorable for the businessmen. And so they knew if they became a territory or a state of the United States, they'd get favorable tax conditions. So for those two reasons, you know, a Hawaiian monarchy that wasn't necessarily sympathetic to big business and tariffs, big businessmen started to advocate for being a territory or a state. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is the United States didn't want a state that was full, and then I mean full of Asians, because the Japanese and Chinese had been coming for decades to help the big business farm the sugar for not much, very cheap labor. So basically what happened was the businessmen basically had a kind of a quiet revolution where they convinced the United States that the Hawaiian monarchy was a threat to everybody on the island, which wasn't true. There was a and the big business took over, and the United States wasn't sure they wanted them to be a territory, but in 1900 they decided, okay, we're not going to have them be a state because there doesn't look like a lot of those people really look American to us, meaning, of course, the Hawaiians and the Asian immigrants. But we will allow it to be a territory, which automatically made everybody there an American citizen.
Now, Pearl Harbor, the base that was bombed in 1941, when was that established?
Pearl Harbor is really interesting, and I love the way it kept coming up in my research. Pearl Harbor was this incredible bay that was perfect for whaling ships and any merchant ships on the way to China, because it could protect them from, you know, the Pacific. And Pearl Harbor was thought by the missionaries to be terrible, terrible land because it was marshland. But when the American Navy and other countries realized what a great outpost it would be, they started trying to get it for themselves. And as a result, the Hawaiians eventually sold. Actually, it was the Haoles who then ran Hawaii, who sold it to the United States in the early 1900s. So we owned Pearl Harbor, but nothing else in Hawaii.
Isn't that sort of derogatory, or isn't that used in a derogatory way?
You know, you can't. There's a lot of theories about the etymology of "hauli." One of them is that it means without breath, which is what I say in my book, and it was a derogatory. It meant that white people weren't really connected to the essence of the land. But that since has actually been...
No, wait a minute. You know, the defense against slander is truth. So you had these people that were this just there to rip off the land, and the native people were a little more connected. Maybe, never mind. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, would you like to be called without breath?
Yeah, well, if the shoe fits kind of deal, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's really true. The Haoles were, I have to say, were really the downfall of the Hawaiians. When they came, they brought their disease, smallpox and influenza, and almost wiped out the Hawaiian population by the end of the 1800s, which is why big business looked to the east for laborers and started bringing in Chinese and Japanese, because the Hawaiian people were dying out, and so was the Hawaiian culture. But the great thing about the interesting thing about that, not the great thing, the interesting thing is that Ni'ihau was so isolated by the Robinson family that, in fact, the Hawaiian culture flourished there, and the Hawaiians flourished there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Caroline Paul. She's the author of the novel, East Wind Rain. It's published by Morrow, and it's the story of a crash landing of a Japanese pilot onto this small, isolated Hawaiian island following the attack on Pearl Harbor. Caroline, if you would, expand a little more on Pearl Harbor itself and when it became a major naval base and what its significance was and the significance of the attack on it by the Japanese.
Well, Pearl Harbor became a naval base for the United States in the early 1900s, I think. You know, it was interesting because I didn't want to write a book about Pearl Harbor because it's been so covered, you know, and it's everybody seems to know a lot about Pearl Harbor. But the one thing they don't know is this little anecdote that I then made into a book, which is about the Japanese pilot that has to crash land on the isolated island. So I can't tell you a ton. I actually know a bit about Pearl Harbor, but I think the experts would probably, you know, have a lot more to say. But I do know that Pearl Harbor was a really important bulwark against what America considered the very aggressive Japanese at the time. And, in fact, my title, East Wind Rain, comes from what's called the Japanese Winds Code, which is the code that the Japanese were going to use to tell their diplomats in certain countries which country they would be attacking. They weren't sure. What they wanted was fuel in Southeast Asia. So they weren't sure if in order to get that they would have to attack Britain, Russia, or the United States. But they were going to let the diplomats know in each of those countries by inserting this WINS code. So then the diplomats could then flee, obviously, before the attack happened. So if it was going to be, if the attack was going to take place in Russia, the weather report from Tokyo would say north wind cloudy. And if it was going to be Britain, the weather report would say west wind clear. And if it was the United States, it would be east wind rain. And on December 4th, 1941, the Tokyo weather forecast was east wind rain.
Yeah, which was the signal. Your book takes place, the novel, on the small island of Ni'ihau. Have you ever been there? Because it's still kind of isolated and off limits.
Well, it's still privately owned by the same family, and I actually asked to go because I wanted to go onto the island and see the village and interview people about maybe their remembrances. There was no one alive who is a character in my book, but I figured that they, you know, had a lot of stories from then. But the owners never answered my letter, which I wasn't surprised because they keep it very, it's their land, it's still their island, and they don't want any outsiders coming in. They do, however, after many years of pressure from the government, have helicopter tours where they'll take tourists to far outreaches. But I didn't want that because I wanted to go into the village.
Are you going to send them a copy of your book?
I haven't thought about that. That's an interesting idea.
Here's my suggestion. Don't do it. I ran into a bit of a problem with someone I wrote about that probably wouldn't have known that I'd written about them unless I sent it to them.
It's interesting. Have you found that what I found in my first book, which was a memoir, where I talked about people, but in that book, ironically, the names were changed. In this book, which is a novel, the names are not changed. But in that book, the people I was kind of nervous about, because maybe I wrote, you know, something, I didn't really write anything really bad about anybody, but if I'd wrote something that I thought, uh-oh, they might not like it. It turns out that you'll find that the people who you think are going to be upset are really not. Maybe they even like what you wrote. And then the people that you thought you wrote great things about suddenly, you know, get very insulted.
Yeah, it's odd to be written about. I mean, from time to time, because of my public persona, I've had pieces written about me, and I think, well, that's what they thought, or that's how they think I look, even like that. So, anyways, let's get back to your book, East Wind Rain. My guest is Caroline Paul, and this is set around Pearl Harbor. It's a novel, and it's a novelization of a historical incident where a Japanese plane crashed following the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, this in itself, of course, would be a very interesting, as it is, very interesting setting for a novel, but the actual historical incident had some impact on U.S. policy towards Japanese, particularly the internment policy. Now, how did the Roosevelt administration, because they finally found out about this, right? Everybody connected the dots eventually that what was going on. Maybe tell us at least historically that end of your book.
Well, I'll back up just a little bit and say that, you know, when this plane crashed on the island, there was mostly Hawaiians on Niihau, but also a Japanese-American couple. And like I said, they knew why the pilot had crashed because they came in to translate. And so then they were faced with this terrible decision. The pilot was pressuring them to help him. And they thought that the Japanese Navy was coming imminently. Of course, we know that that wasn't how the Japanese planned the situation. They were going to attack, hoping to sink the Pacific Fleet in order to get access to the Southeast Asia oil. But, you know, you can understand why someone on an isolated island would hear, oh, I've just attacked Pearl Harbor. We've decimated everything. And of course, they think the Japanese are coming. And so they were faced with this choice. Do they help the pilot, and then when the Japanese come, they're treated as Japanese? Or do they stand with their Hawaiian neighbors, tell them why he's there, and then figure it out? And at the time, Japanese Americans were treated really like second-class citizens. And Hawaii was maybe a little better because actually Japanese outnumbered Haoles on Kauai, for instance, 10-1. So Hawaii was better when it came to treating its Asian population and its Japanese Americans, but California was terrible. And these Japanese Americans, the Haradas, understood that they might be blamed for anything that Japan did. And in fact, that is what happened. But here on Niihau, they had to face the choice that about who they were and who were they really, allied with. They had never been treated as Americans, and yet they, of course, weren't Japanese, but that's how people viewed them. And that's really what this book is about, the 7 days where they agonize over the decisions they have to make as a result of this plane crashing on this island. And the great thing about this is that the Hawaiians are also American citizens, but they don't feel American either. I mean, they feel Hawaiian, or as they often say in the book, Niihauan. So I love that irony, where a little island that's American actually doesn't feel American at all.
Now, what's at work here? I've always wondered that. I mean, the Germans, of course, were our enemies during World War II as well. In fact, they were actively involved in espionage, and there was great sympathy for the Nazis among many Germans. They had groups here in Michigan, like the German-American Bund. Actually, it was nationwide, but they had an expression here, and they had the Silver Shirts, which were also pro-Nazis, and no one thought of interning Germans. Yet, here was the great liberal, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that in 1942 orders the internment of over 100,000 Japanese-Americans, to which no espionage or crime had ever been attributed.
Well, actually, he didn't order the internment of Japanese Americans. He ordered the internment of those of enemy ancestry. And there were German Americans and Italian Americans who were interned. But there was the Japanese Americans were by far the biggest group. They basically cleared out all of the California Japanese and Japanese Americans and put them in intern camps.
A lot of that was a land grab in many ways. Get rid of economic competitors, grab their farms, stuff like that. That's true?
Yes, I had heard the same thing. Well, ironically, in Hawaii, where this happened, where clearly the Japanese thought it was important to attack, so you would think if there was enemies there, you'd need to clear them off Hawaii, there were only 500 Japanese and Japanese-American who were interned there. So, clearly this wasn't a logical situation. In California, the prejudice, they called the, Asians the yellow peril.
Sure.
And the prejudice was just terrible. And so I think it was a dual thing. It was that, yes, they would, the Japanese were marched off overnight, and neighbors took what they had. And when they came back, there was no proof that they had ever owned anything. So, yes, I think there was a big economic aspect to this, born of prejudice.
Did your research show why or what particular Japanese ancestry were rounded up in Hawaii? I mean, there were Japanese that had great sympathy for the empire as well. Was it they?
Well, it was anybody who they thought. I don't exactly know what the reasons were, but I think they sat down and thought who might be an enemy, as opposed to California, where they rounded everybody up. I mean, mm-hmm. they might have been wrong. I mean, of the 500 they rounded up, maybe there was nobody there who was an enemy. Maybe they all were an enemy. Who I don't know, but I do know that at least in Hawaii, they sat and thought about it and tried to discern who, based on much more than just being Japanese or Japanese-American, might be some sort of threat to the United States.
Well, no, I guess if Ronald Reagan apologized, it was he, wasn't it, who signed that, reparations and apology, they must have been blame-free. I think that's true.
Well, I think that's really true. You know, they did apologize for those actions. You know, there was a book that came out, I don't know if you covered it, called In Defense of Internment. Did you read about it?
I know that it exists, yeah.
Yeah, it was a bestseller for a while. Well, ironically, this woman, who's a Filipino-American, she uses Ni'ihau as an example for a reason why racial profiling is a good thing, which is really irresponsible, in my opinion, because if you've delved into that situation where the Japanese-American couple did eventually help the pilot, you understand that really the reason that the Japanese-American couple, the Haradas, did that is not because they felt an allegiance to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It's because the island was so isolated, they just didn't know what was going on the outside world in the way that everybody else did in the mainland and in Hawaii. And so to use that as an example of why it was okay on hindsight to round up Japanese and Japanese-Americans is just crazy.
Caroline Paul, your first book was a memoir of the years you spent as a member of the San Francisco Fire Department's Elite Rescue Squad. Your second and book just about to be released by William Morrow is East Wind Rain. There's not a pattern here. What is there a third book in Caroline Paul's mind?
Well, to go back to the pattern thing, you know, most people, when they start a novel, they usually write kind of about themselves in disguise.
Right, sure.
Everybody thinks it's an autobiographical novel. Well, I wrote a memoir first, so I got that out of my system. So I've now written a book where I am not anybody in this book. You know, there is no white girl from Connecticut in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I have some ideas about my next book, and it's going to be as off track as these two. I'm thinking about UFOs.
Okay, well, we're always ready for that. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. The book is a novel, East Wind Rain. It's a debut novel, second book written by Caroline Paul. A little known chapter in our history, the crash landing of a Japanese pilot onto an outlying Hawaiian island featuring an attack on Pearl Harbor, and it's published by William Morrow. And is there a website? I forgot to ask you about that.
CarolinePaul.com.
Okay. I'll go to it, and I'll have a link on my website, PeterWerby.com. Caroline Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. 101 The Riff. Everything that rocks.